on my left here. Yes, thank you very much for coming at short notice. And how many of you don't appear to be sufficient seating capacity? Have you got enough additional? Right, this is some upstairs or something, yeah. And members of the committee, I notice you're back with us again, Honourable Nkongi, and I'm glad to see you over that energy there. So on. Thank you very much. And also members right on the in the back row. Yes, is everyone in the back row a member of this committee? Right, who isn't? All right, just so that I can see you there. Right, okay. I just want to see if there's anything that I should be adding here. I should note that I have asked the staff to distribute the contract of the CEO of the National Regulator for Compulsory Services, the contract, which we did address this at a previous meeting in which we sought legal advice as to whether or not we would be entitled to request this, and that was very carefully spelled out by one of the legal advisors of Parliament. There's also a letter from the Auditor General's office to accompany this. Are you all in possession of that? Right. And the other issues, let's see, I'm not sure if Mr. Herman handed this out. Mm-hmm. So that you would already have the information provided by the DTI and its entities as requested by the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. If there's anything that you believe we asked for that is not here, please raise your hand now. You're looking at what I'm looking at? Page that looks like that? You don't have it. That's what I asked for. I'd like a copy of that for everyone. And the reason for that is, you know, we'll be concluding the BRR shortly, BRR, and we want to make sure you've got all the documentation. Now, where is it? There's also another matter that I have to address in the opening. You will recall that we have been invited to join the minister to Cuba to go to the trade exhibition there in Havana. And that, regrettably, I got a letter dated yesterday indicating that the minister has had to reprioritize other projects, and or rather other projects have been reprioritized, and funds have followed those projects, and consequently the department and the ministry will not be attending except for one functionary in that regard. The whole purpose of us accompanying the minister was to do some oversight in that regard. That trip now falls away, notwithstanding the application that we made to speaker, which we will now in a letter withdraw it, giving the reasons for the withdrawal of that. Thank you, Mr. Herman, on that particular one. I think that covers everything that is outstanding. We can now go towards the adoption. And that is Mr. Jenkins. Please just address briefly the request that I gave him in regard to the letter I received from the Auditor General. Right. So that immediately, after apologies and before the NRCS speak, Mr. Advocate Jenkins will address that request. Thank you very much. Can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda with that amendment? Thank you, Honourable William, seconded by Honourable Quirinoff. Right. Advocate Frank Jenkins, can you please address the letter which every member has from the Auditor General's office?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning, members and colleagues, members of the public. So, I'd like to understand this letter. It just sets out the detail for the committee to assist in compiling its BRRR, in assisting, in other words, to make an assessment of the performance of this entity that's part of the mandate of the Department of Trade and Industry. So it covers 3 years and then sets out the reasons for the qualifications. Each year that it looks at receive a qualification. So certainly there's a pattern that the committee can look at and of course make certain recommendations going forward in terms of findings, etc., etc. Now, ma'am, I know that there have been some issues around this, but one must understand the audit process, and I've also been supplied the PowerPoint presentation of the Auditor General to the committee. I don't know if it has been presented, and set out nice, in my view, sets up very nicely the process that the Auditor General goes through and the criteria it uses. So that, keeping that in mind, one must remember the AG is not, neither am I or anybody, in fact, perfect in giving his advice. But there's a moment where the AG, in doing the audit, has a certain process. And the Auditor General can actually elaborate on this, but there's management, a draft report that's submitted to management and management responds to that. And there must be a proper interaction between the auditee and the AG itself. That being said, when the AG finalizes its report and it comes to Parliament for this letter, as a Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa, Parliament takes this as correct. The Public Audit Act allows the AG to submit further audit reports if it wants to bring out certain clarities or not. So what it says, ma'am, is that there has been areas of concern, there have been actually qualifications, in other words, that the AG could not form a proper opinion on certain of the issues and were quite concerned about some of the accounting standards that have been used. It looks as if it got a little bit better because the emphasis shifts a little bit towards the last financial year. But nevertheless, it remains a qualified audit. There's still work to be done, and there's some measures that I've read that's been put in place, it's all in the letter, that measures that's been put in place to address those accounting issues. And it's important to remember that this is a 3-year cycle, so if you do not correct what you did last year and the year before, you're going to continue to get qualified audits. And so you've brought your accounting standards up to scratch and up to standard. So man, that's where I don't want to take too much of the committee's time. But that's where it stands, and yes, obviously there will be differences of opinion, but it's not for this committee. I mean, one of the things, go get your house in order then. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Advocate Jenkins. Looking at members of the committee, do you wish to comment, request clarification? You're happy, fine. Thank you very much. So, on that note then, we can turn back to the agenda itself and call on the national regulator. But at the beginning, I know we don't, just in a minute there, Honourable Hill News, I'm just looking for Mr. Whittington. Well, where is the register, please? Right, it makes it difficult to recognise people without the register, but let me at least acknowledge yourself. But before that, there is a hand from the committee. Honourable Hillis.
Chair, what would be the appropriate point to discuss the performance contract that we've received this morning?
I think what would be useful is to get that after T, if that still remains the case, T. And you've got the RCS on the annual report, because the contract is linked to that, all right? Yeah. So, can we please ask Mr. Mooney to take the floor, introduce his team as you move along, but at the very least I can acknowledge the out of the general, and that's Mr. Lionel October, the most senior member of the EPI here today. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jefferson. And I'll just introduce who's with me here this morning. The CFO, Ms. Reshma Madura, will give you the financial part of the reports. And of course, we'll introduce the DG October. Next DG is Mr. Bonani Kanile, the General Manager of the Electrotechnical Unit. Of course, he's responsible for the LOEs in the Electrotechnical Unit. The next thing we have Lance Riano. Lance Riano is the Project Manager for the RBA, for the Defense Approach. And next to Lance, we have Mandlam Kibera. Mandlam Kibera is the CIO, the Chief Information Officer for the NRCS. Then in the background, we have Eric Batemba, the gentleman who is in the PMG. Eric Batemba is our Strategy and Risk Manager. Next to Edward is Teboho Apane, our Legal Senior Manager, Legal Services. Edward is responsible for Strategy and Risk, and he will probably is here to assist in terms of the annual report and the first part of performance. Teboko is responsible, or is responsible for the policy and the information around the risk-based approach. He's been working with the team of attorney to get that developed. And Macy is, of course, always here because she's our general manager in charge of the Cape Town office. So she normally has seen all the logistics and to answer some questions as well. I can introduce the DCI team as well. Dr. Damana is here, chief director in the IBD section. And then it's, he is also a chief director in the Public Oversight Unit, and well, you know sort of which. Okay, as the gentleman says, as I was introducing, so that's the team that we have here this morning. Then. So the agenda for us to deal with the risk-based approach that we've started implementing the first, and I'm going to deal with that. I didn't anticipate that we've distributed our updated version of the presentation. The updated version simply includes a slide on the acronyms, and there were a few typographical errors, but the content remains the same.
I would just appeal to you all to note your question so that we don't interrupt the presentation to start with. Is that clear?
Sorry, can I just ask for indulgence? I'm just sorry, Madam Chair. There's something wrong with the presentation that I'm assisting.
That is happening just as an aside because they're fixing that the technicalities there. You all know you made a contribution to Mrs. Sheldon's and Abe's you know, the impending birth of a child. Well, of course, the child arrived, the baby, and I should let you know it is a baby boy, and he certainly seemed to have bounced out. Of course, his daddy is a rugby player, so that may be the reason. And anyway, he made the contribution, but because I didn't know the gender of the child, I sort of refrained from purchasing anything just yet. We do have a card, which you'll sign, and the amount that was collected from all of you sitting here, and I'm looking around, yes, indeed, was something like 2,400. And I really think they appreciate that very, very much. We didn't stipulate what they should buy, but simply we handed it over, as the Honourable MacPherson knows, because he saw us, myself, with the staff, they received this, and they're most appreciative. Of course, we are all hoping that this bouncing baby boy will very soon be walking so that Miss Sheldon can come. He's back. It's going to be Edward. Thank you. Or are we, when Miss Matunda comes in with a card, you'll know why. All right? And we are sending her some flowers from the chairperson's discretionary account. Thank you. On that note, back to you. Are we on track?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam, for that indulgence. We have a great presentation on the board now. So, Madam Chair, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the ROA and the high volumes, and we're focusing specifically on the electrotechnical environment here. And after the LOAs and what we mean in terms of the interventions, we will talk about the risk-based approach, the methodology, the implementation, and then we'll talk a bit about the ICT progress as an enabler for the risk-based approach. So essentially, just a little bit of background, but the committee is aware of this background already, but just to refresh our memories. Prior to 2008, recall that we shared that we received approximately 400 applications a month in the electrotechnical environment. And then in 2012-13, we implemented the risk-based approach for our work, that's called surveillance work, where order enforcement and source inspection became a key factor. And we concentrated a considerable amount of effort because of entry and the sources of manufacture and sources of products. Just to clarify that in the NRCS definition, in terms of jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, source refers to the point of manufacture in the country and the point that the product enters the country. We have territorial jurisdiction, so that's how we have defined source in terms of the NRCS. So what has happened is that we've allocated a considerable amount of effort at the cost of entry and the source of manufacture within the country for one very simple reason. We prevent non-compliant, unsafe and substandard products from entering safe at their point of entry into the economy. It's very difficult to allow products going to trade, find that they are non-compliant or unsafe, and then to try and recall all those products. Madam Chair, some of these products are of such nature that they find themselves in far-gone areas, such as the rural areas and so forth. And the impact, as you already know, is catastrophic. So to recall those products would be very, very difficult. You're already aware that South Africa has seen huge amounts of casualties, fatality as a result of non-compliant products. So the approach was that we keep these products out of trade before they enter trade. And the source is where we look to keep these products out of trade. When we devote our effort to the source, we noted that the number of applications for LOAs then moved from 400 to approximately 1,000 to 1 per month. And as I said previously in this committee, it meant that prior to our focusing attention at the source of the products into the country or into trade, only 400, I mean, if you look at the average, it's 400 over 1,000 tons, about 40%, almost 40% of people comply with the regulatory requirements. It means the other 60% do not comply. But clearly there's been some turnaround in that, and now we find that a lot of people are complying with the requirement to get their products pre-approved before it comes into the marketplace. So that has resulted in a huge increase in the number of LOAs. But what is more important, and I think that is very critical for us to note, is that we found huge quantities of non-compliant, unsafe products entering our country and entering into trade. The figures I've been given for a number of 4 years now in our annual report presentation, quarterly report presentations, in terms of the quantities of non-compliant products, unsafe products that are coming into the country and coming into trade. So we found that our pre-market approval process had to become a lot more rigorous. We had to convince ourselves, to assure ourselves that indeed the products that we were approving to enter into trade was safe for the consumer and for the environment, and that's in accordance with our mandate. As I mentioned previously, our mandate is very simple. We protect the consumer and the environment from unsafe, non-compliant products. We promote fair trade, and we have a responsibility in promoting the uniform understanding of the building standards and the building regulations. So that is basically our mandate, and our pre-market approval system is designed to ensure that only compliant, safe products enter trade in North Africa. And as I said, we found that huge quantities of non-compliant products were coming into the country, and we had really apply a very rigorous process to then ensure that those products that we had approved are safe for the consumer and for the environment. It can be said that products that a significant proportion of the products that are traded in the country are still not safe and still not compliant. Of course, we're doing everything possible to identify these products and take necessary action where it is required. And but the rigor with which we have to do our work is very important in order to protect the consumer and the environment. So this is just the brief background, and then we, on average for 2016-17, the number of applications for LOAs, and this is mainly important for us, increased from 1,200 to approximately 1,300 a month, shows an increase in the number of LOAs for products that are coming to the country. Previously, it took 21 days. We moved last year 120 working days. Madam Chair, you'll recall that there were a considerable amount of concern raised with regard to the 120 working days, and then after a series of engagements, the Minister then approved that we moved from 120 working days to 120 calendar days, which in a sense was a 30% reduction in the turnaround time for LOAs that was supposed to be issued to applicants. So essentially, we moved from a 6-month period to a 4-month period from 2015-16 to 2016-17. In the electric technical environment, prior to 2008, there was 4 compulsory specifications that we were working with. That has moved now to 18 compulsory specifications, which requires regulatory activities and input. So in terms of the background that we have, we've made this information available to Parliament last week, ma'am. You'll find that in total we have 1,653 LOAs that are more than 120 days, and in average there are 153 days outstanding, and there's the breakdown there in terms of the number, the quantity, and the average number of days that they are outstanding as of last week, as of Friday last week. So, in order to address this backlog and bring the LOAs within the 120 day period, we've implemented a series of interventions. We've already implemented them, which will, in the very short term, between September and October, bring us back to normality as far as the LOAs are concerned. The first thing that we've done, Madam Chair, is to separate the administrative processes from technical processes. Now, up to now, what has happened is that the technical inspectors, or the evaluators, were carrying out all the administrative and the technical checks on the technical evaluation of the LOAs. So what we've done is we've used a system of checklists to identify the administrative process. And administrative processes are things like, is the application complete? Are the test reports attached? Is the test report valid? Are product details complete from the application and so forth? We've separated those administrative processes from the technical evaluation, which is really combined with the certifications. We've then allocated a number of administrative assistance personnel to look at the administrative processes of an LOA. And then once the administrative processes have been dealt with and the LOA can go for further technical evaluation, it is then to the technical evaluators for further evaluation. And this deals mainly with the low and medium risk products, which I will speak about just now as we go along. Then we developed and piloted the risk-based approach so far. And we're phasing in this in a staged approach. But right now, we are still doing this manually, and I will explain in a little while how we are doing this process, the risk-based approach, how we're implementing it manually, whilst we're developing an automated system for this. So in terms of the risk-based approach, renewals, we've automatically classified them as low risk for one simple reason, is that as long as the product composition has not changed and the test report remains valid, validated period of the testament that the bottom remains, then there's no reason, as long as we've issued an array previously, there's no reason for us not to issue the array again. So this is automatically goes into the low-risk category, and we deal with this in terms of the low-risk approach. Now here, we want to clarify that we don't find that there will be risk or to consumer or to the environment, but these applications have previously been technically evaluated to and found to be compliant. We don't make a distinction between who the applicant or application is. It's simply a renewal, and if it meets the renewal criteria, then we look at the TRSD in the low-risk category. Local manufacturers, you look at them at the low-risk category because they are able to go to the manufacturing concerns, look at the quality manufacturing processes, the conformity of assessment processes, and we are able to make a determination. The same with components that are imported and brought into the country. These components go through a sort of quality processing. We are able to determine the quality of the processing, place reliance on the processes and the processing capabilities and the quality management systems of these companies that are assembling the components, and we are able to classify them into low risk. Of course, where we cannot take that reliance, then they don't fall into the low risk category. Then another immediate intervention is that we, four of our inspectors have qualified as inspectors. They were previously candidate inspectors. They have now qualified as inspectors at the end of August. We've allocated all four of them to deal with LOA processing. So you find that the capacity has increased by 40% now in that area, just like this four inspectors, but I will tell you how we've increased our capacity in a few minutes. The electrotechnical inspectors that normally do surveillance, that are inspections at the point of entry, at the source and manufacturing in South Africa and at the marketplace, we've also brought them in to assist with looking at LOA approvals. Remember, they are highly qualified technical people, so they are capable of evaluating in LOAs, so we brought them to evaluate LOAs as well, and they are assisting the unit in these evaluations. Furthermore, Madam Chair, on the 2nd of September, I issued an instruction to the entire organization that all the surveillance inspectors in all the other business units, because they are all technically qualified people, very highly qualified people. I remember at one stage we mentioned here, Madam Chair, that before an inspector becomes principal inspector, they will have to have a technical qualification and go through 7 years of training. So they're very highly trained personnel. We've asked all the surveillance inspectors to assist in the evaluation of the LOA for electrotechnical unit during the month of September and October, and I will just talk about that a little bit right now. Further to that, we have approved that two additional candidate inspectors be appointed in the unit, and that appointment is process is currently underway. Madam Chair, to say that we, as a government entity, we of course will have to comply with all the recruitment selection and sort of selection and recruitment processes. So we are following that at the moment, and these two candidate inspectors should be appointed shortly. That would add to the four that we already have allocated at the end of August. In addition to that, we've moved two surveillance inspectors on a more permanent basis to the LOA approvals process. So we've had the four qualified in at the end of August, and a further two of the surveillance inspectors we've moved into LOA evaluations. So that makes it six, and then we have two candidate inspectors coming in, which makes eight. So you'll find that the number of people in that unit looking at LOA evaluations since September now is increased 150%. So that would have a serious positive impact on the evaluation of LOAs. I mentioned that the line function surveillance inspectors from other BUs have been asked to be assist, and we have calculated that just the assistance from the other BUs alone would clear 2,500 LOAs in the months of September and October, and this really will clear the backlogs and bring the current status into a much more positive position. So all of that has been implemented already. The the four inspectors have already started working, the two surveillance inspectors have already started working, and the line function BUs have already been working for the additional training in terms of the electrotechnical environment, and they will start with the evaluation of, they have started with the evaluation of the airways for the electrotechnical BU. The two candidate inspectors, the recruitment and selection is underway. In the short to medium term, we have other interventions to assist us in the electric area capacity, and wants to use the LA capacity for my business unit. So what we are doing right now, MJ, is that we are undertaking a very comprehensive exercise to determine the capacity that we have in other business units, because we find that the pressure that we are facing is mainly in the electrotechnical environment. So clearly we have capacity in the other units to determine whether we can bring all the capacity from all the units into one unit. And we have an equitable approach to the alloys, which would also assist quite considerably in the turnaround times for the alloys. Then, of course, the most important intervention in the short to medium term is the finalization of our ICT system to support our alloy process, and more specifically the risk-based approach. But Madam Chair, I will deal with that in detail towards that part of this presentation. Having said that, in terms of the backlog and what the interventions are that we've implemented in the short term and the intentions for the short to medium term, I want to now just focus a bit on the risk-based approach methodology that we've adopted for the NRCS. Just as a precursor, Madam Chair, I just want to say that, recall that I've been here several times to say that up to now, there was no probability, possibility of the NRCS according to preferential treatment to any applicant. When applications were made, they would stand in the queue and we would address them when their turn came, because our regulatory policies and our regulatory mandate did not allow us to make preferential treatment to any applicant. So we've gone into a very exhaustive process to determine whether there can be some approach that we use to recognize applications that are, that have a history of compliance, that have a history of complying, of creating a compliance culture, of complying with our regulatory requirements, and how is it that we could have a different approach to that, those kinds of applications. And this is where we have explored the risk-based approach. It seems to be an approach that is used internationally in other places as well. And we, as I mentioned previously, we had appointed a firm of attorneys to assist us to determine whether we have to now deal with this as additional regulations in terms of the World Trade Organization, or how do we deal with this in terms of allowing us to recognize the compliance histories and the compliance culture of applications and applicants. So we have had the input from the firm of attorneys, and they've advised us that we have to have a policy that is developed, and once we have accepted policy, then we can actually use this approach in terms of recognizing the compliance culture of certain applications and applicants. So just as a matter of background, according to ACTA 2005, there's many hundreds of definitions of risk-based approach. Internal auditing has a definition, the auditing professional has a definition, but they all converge generally on the basic concepts. The risk-based approach centers on determining the probability impact factors, that is, what is the expectation of the risk occurring, and should the risk occur, what would be the consequences of the risk occurring, probability impact. Then once we've determined that, to decide upon the regulatory response in terms of the different, or the calculation of the probability impact. And then, of course, developing our regulatory tools and then informing allocated decisions in using the limited resources that we have, the scarce resources that we have. So basically, the risk-based approach in terms of the NRCs, by the way, just as a last glimpse, all the acronyms here, we have a paid acronyms at the end of the presentation, and they explain again. Our risk-based approach entails concentrating our regulatory enforcement on areas of higher risk, whilst we reduce the intensity. We have a different approach and turn frequencies on those companies that are generally found to have a compliance culture, and we are able to confirm this compliance culture. So essentially what he's saying is that where there is evidence and a history of higher risk, then we will devote a lot more attention to those areas. In the lower risk, we're not going to not devote any attention at all. There will be attention devoted to the area of lower risk, but in a more or less intensive scale. And this will be based on objective criteria that involves profiling and depending on the risk rating. So profiling will give us a risk rating, and we'll talk about the risk rating in a few minutes now. Our regulatory rules and processes will be developed, and these are already being developed and will be implemented, and the pilot phase has already been implemented. And we will have a periodic review of the system and the participants. We emphasize that the periodic review will take place half yearly, once every 6 months. that is at the outset, and if there's a need for us to review periodic reassessment of the system and the participants, then we will go into an explorative study to determine what the periodic review should be. So, in terms of the risk-based framework, we have two stages of assessment. The first is the administrative compliance assessment stage, and then the technical compliance assessment stage. I mentioned this a little earlier in terms of the administrative compliance. The administrative compliance is to determine whether the application meets the administrative requirements, and this is the completeness of the application, the attachment of all the required documentation, all the information that is supposed to be completed is on the application, and whatever information is required in terms of making an assessment. If the application passes through the administrative compliance assessment stage, then it goes to the technical. It will go going into capturing, and then it will go into the technical compliance assessment stage. At the administrative compliance assessment stage, should the application do not meet the requirements, then this will be an automatic rejection and to be sent back to the applicant for further processing. The technical compliance assessment stage then happens after the administrative compliance stage, and this deals with determining whether the product complies with the technical regulations, the composite specifications. And that means determining whether the product and the information made available complies with the DCs. We envisage that in full implementation, we've started the pilot implementation, and I'll talk about that just now. In full implementation, low-risk applications will be processed with a 75 calendar days, up to 75 calendar days. Medium-risk applications will be processed up to 9 calendar days, and high-risk applications will be processed within 150 calendar days. And earlier, Madam Chair, given the interventions that we had implemented already during September to meet with this turnaround time. Now, in terms of the risk model, these are some of the factors. These are factors that are taken into consideration in terms of the risk-based approvals. We take three high-level factors. One is the company risk. The other is the product risk. And the third is the country of origin risk. Then we look at, I'm going to give each of these just in a few minutes. Then we look at certain downstream factors, and I think some of our colleagues who are here, who are not members of the government, will probably be able to see here. Consignment-based applications and conformity assessment bodies using the certificate of conformity approach. We will use that as a downstream factor to determine whether an application will be processed in the low risk category. And then we have one further factor, which is compliance in a participation in a self-compliance scheme. But okay, we've been encouraging certain companies. We've been in engagement with a few industry participants recently over the last year or so to have a self-compliance scheme. A self-compliance scheme is very simple. All persons, industries, and entities who trade in the South African economy must comply with the regulations and the regulatory requirements, compulsory specifications. That is not negotiable. So, what we are trying to encourage here is that whether or not the NRC comes to visit you once or twice or 50 times a year, the fact that a company has to comply, it has no alternative but to comply with the regulatory requirements. We are encouraging a system of self-compliance where they themselves look at the regulatory requirements and ensure that all their products and services comply with the regulatory requirements. Now, we are following the approach that we actually recognize the self-compliance by these industry participants. We enter into engagement with them, we enter into a memorandum or a contract with them, and we recognize that these companies or industry participants have actually elected to move into the self-compliance scheme where they have their own quality process in place to ensure that no non-compliant or unsafe products are traded by their entities, and we recognize this by lowering the intensity of the regulatory activities for those companies. So companies that are participating in self-compliance scheme, this is a voluntary requirement, it's not a regulatory requirement, where they voluntarily decide to participate in the self-compliance scheme, obviously with in good interaction with us, then this will also impact or be one of the factors that will take that application or that company into the lowest category for the outputs. So basically our risk engine at the moment look at product risk, company risk, and country risk, and we'll get a risk rating. But then we will take two down, additional downstream factors, which is a COC conformity, a certificate of conformity, and the self-compliance agreements that we have with certain identified companies. By the way, when I say identified companies, this will be available to anybody who wishes to participate in the scheme. We would not make this determination. The company, we would of course offer this across the industry, and the companies themselves would determine whether they want to participate in the scheme so that they can be considered in the, that can be considered for the lower risk category. Now, this is how the risk factors work. In terms of the product risk, country risk, and company risk, for the moment, for now, we are using one simple, not simple, but one factor, that is the compliance history and the compliance behavior of the product, country, and the company, because that's the information that is easily available, well, not easily available, but is available to us at this moment in time. We have intelligence or information on the companies on how they, what their compliance history is like, using that. Products, that is a standard. There are certain products that are high risk. For example, parfums are automatically high risk, whereas I don't know if I can say this, but sometimes there's some ICT equipment that may be automatically low risk, like an iPad. Low risk, iPad, even iPad. Unless, of course, if it's one of those iPads with a petroleum patch. That, of course, is I'm not saying which one it was. Then, of course, already there's an international alert on that IT equipment, so that automatically impacts on the screen. So, having those paraffin heaters and so forth, automatically those products. So the product risk is a sort of more or less inherent risk. It's probably a static risk, but it can change over time depending on components and on the materials that are used and manufacturing approach to the product. So we have the kind of information that we can determine the compliance history or the behavior of products. Country is a little difficult. We normally look at the international alerts from each country or against each country, and then we are able to make a determination on the compliance history of the company as the country as well. But I would, you will see in a few minutes now that because it's, the ability to get information on products and companies is a lot more objective, we place a lot more weight and reliance on the compliance history of the product and of the African company, and have a very low weight on the country itself. But I'll come to that just now. Downstream in the near future, we will look at further risk factors, the inherent risk or impact of failure of product, available through market intelligence, and that exploring battery is a very good example of our market intelligence to give us that kind of information. Whether it is a new compulsory specification or an existing compulsory specification, because clearly, the new compulsory specification, we wouldn't have any information, so automatically it should be an ISO product. Whereas if it's an existing compulsory specification and we have a lot of information on it, then we could make an easy determination there. The extent of utilization of the product is very important. Paraffin stove is used extensively in this country. Millions of households in the informal settlements across the country use paraffin stove. And the impact of non-compliant, unsafe paraffin stove is catastrophic, as we already see. It's no more risk, it's eventuality, that's that. And of course, the propensity for failure of the product. But as I said, manager, that these will be downstream factors that we are going to look at in the future. For now, we are looking at the compliance history of the product. In terms of the country risk factor, again, international alerts will give us an indication of compliance history. But then we would look at the type of product coming out from the country. I do not wish to choose any countries here, but we have evidence that a similar product originating from two different countries can have a different risk approach to it. I've got a BlackBerry here. A BlackBerry emanating from one country could be unsafe, whereas a BlackBerry emanating from another country could be completely safe. So we look at the type of products, the volume and the value of the consignment coming through from those countries, and is it from a transit or original country? Because remember that we have various different products that are coming from various different places. For example, if you look at a car, a motor vehicle, the brake pads could be manufactured in one country, the engine in another country, the tires in the third country, and it can be assembled in the fourth country. So we look at all those factors. And of course, if the brake pads are manufactured in a country that generally, where brake pads that comes from there are non-compliant, then of course that would impact on the risk rating as well. And the technical acceptance arrangement, this really talks to the regulatory regime of the country, or part of the country. If they have a strong regulatory environment, then of course we can place a lot more reliance on that. If the regulatory environment is somewhat weaker, then we'll have to consider how we can rely on that. And are there any local international compliant alerts? I've mentioned the battery exploding machines, so we get the international alerts and the World Trade Organization also issues some international alerts on these products and companies. With regard to company, again, I think the most important factor is compliance issue and compliance behavior, compliance culture of the company itself. That's in the short term. In the future, we have to look at some other risk factors, and that is the sustainability of the company. I mean, a company that has been in existence for several years, they have various risks in terms of having non-compliant products, and they generally would not want to go down that route. The other possible is we could get the information judgment history against the company would use that. Clearly, NRCS registration is very important. Companies that want to enter into the trade in regulated products is a requirement for NRCS registration. We would then link with the CIPC to get CIPC registration details. We look at the geographical location of the company, and I want to just give an example here because we've had actual examples of geographic location where two companies that are situated close to the borders of our neighboring countries were manufacturing products that were really non-compliant.
I would like you to listen to what the CEO is saying. We requested him, and he's referring to some of the body issues as well. Thank you.
So we've had companies that manufactured non-compliant products, but they were far out in the rural areas, and I think a certain degree of safety was accorded by it because of the geographical location, so we're going to look at that as well. Then we look at the DB payments history of the company. We've already started looking at that as part of our space approach, where industry participants owe DBs and other regulatory costs, and these have not been paid. We will take that into consideration. I mentioned the NRCS self-compliant CBA schemes, and then of course the reputational risk to the company is of critical importance to us as well. That will influence the risk rating category of the applicants as well. So, Madam Chair, these are basically the risk factors that we are going to use. And just to re-emphasize that at the moment, we started with the first one, which is really compliance history. And as we progress and we are able to implement this risk-based approach successfully, then we will build in the other risk factors into the model. Now, how will the risk rating work? This is how the risk rating will work. As I said, we are going to use a weight against the product risk, the company risk, and the country of origin risk. And as you can see, the country of origin risk is given the lowest rating of 10%, the product risk is given the highest rating of 50%, and the company is given a very, very close rating to the product in terms of 40%. So essentially, your company and your product risk would probably have biggest influence on the risk rating, because the country of origin would simply influence it to a less extent. I'll tell you how this works just now. At the bottom, you'll see the formula there. The risk rating would be the country of origin risk weighted by its percentage, plus the product risk weighted by its percentage, and the company, the applicant's risk weighted by its percentage. I'm going to give you the formula just now. And this is how, but before I go to the application of this formula, remember, recall at the beginning I mentioned probably an impact. So we take probably the impact factors and then we do the rating. Now, we use a Likert scale of probability and impact, and we have allowed a maximum of 5 for high-risk probability and maximum of 5 for high-risk. So if the probability is that the product is a high-risk product, the highest risk we can allocate is risk rating is 5. If the probability is that it is a very low-risk product, then the lowest risk rating can be allocated is at 1. However, regardless of the probability, we look then at the impact. If the impact of failure of the product is going to be high, then that risk would be 5. And again, we can use the paraffin stove, regardless of whether the paraffin stove has a high probability of failure. But if should the impact of failure be high, then it would fall into the category of 5. But where the impact is low, for example, if it's an iPad and the impact is very low, then it will fall into the lowest category of 1, or depending on the impact, it will fall in between 1 and 5. So this is the key. So what we would do is we would multiply the probability or the impact to get the inherent or the risk rating of that product applicant or the product itself. We'll come to the applications now. So essentially, a high-risk product, let's take a balance of, the probability of failure of a paraffin stove is high. The impact in the event of failure is extremely high, but we don't have an extremely high category, but it's high. So we allocate 5 to probability and 5 to impact. So the risk of that product is 25. So it goes right on top of the 25. It's in the red category. So all of the high risk products will be 15, 16, 15, 25. From 15, well, from above 12, really. Anything that falls above 12 is high risk. Then if it falls within 6 and 12, as I said, very medium risk, and anything under 6 would be a low risk. The lowest risk rate would be 101. So it is probable that a product can be in the one category. Once we determine the impact and the probability factor, then we determine the risk of the application itself. And we use the three risk factors that I've discussed, the country of origin, the product, and the effect. And this is how we deal with it. Let's take the paraffin stove. We've already determined that the paraffin stove is high risk. Okay. So if the product is high risk, then we take, you will recall that we allocate 50% of risk to the product. So we take 50% and we multiply by 25 and we'll probably get 12.5. So we take 12.5 and we could have put 12.5 in that product, in that column there. And the company, we take 40% of 25, plus 40% of 25, that should be 12 or 11 or something. Okay. We put it there and the 10% of 25 is 0.5. Now that's easy, 12.5. It's 10, it'll be 12.5, 10 and 2.5. That should be the answers. 4% should be 10. So when you add 12.5, 10 and 2.5, then the total risk rating of that product is 25, that application is 25. So it automatically falls into the high risk category, and we will give it the attention in terms of high risk approach. Now let's take an iPad. Let's say the iPad is right at the bottom of the column. It's a, the rating is 1, 1 and 1 is 1. So the product 50% times 1 will be 1 or half, because so we'll take that into 0.5. 40% of 1, let's use 1 will be 4, so it's 0.4, and then 10% of 1 will be 0.1, so 0.5 plus 0.4 plus 0.1 would come to 1. So the risk of that application would be 1. It's a very low risk application. So we've addressed it in terms of the low risk category. So this is the model that we are using. We've implemented in the pilot study to deal with applications. Of course, in order to for a company or an industry to benefit from this approach here, the company will have to prove to us their compliance is really in compliance. We have our own information, and I will talk to that just now, but there's nothing stopping the industry buses have been proving to us their compliance, and compliance behavior. And of course, the product, we make our determination in terms of the risk of the products. We have a very objective way of determining the risk of products and so forth. But that is basically the approach in terms of the risk-based approach. Now, having said all of that, Madam Chair, you would find that this is all in a policy document that has been developed, and we've given the final input to the firm attorneys that have been assisting us, and they are finalizing the final draft of the documentation, and we are desirous that that will come into policy, that become formal policy in a very short period of time. But we've already started the approach, having got the go-ahead from the firm of attorneys that it is in fact in compliance with all the legal requirements that we have to comply with. Now, what have we done so far? By the end of March 2016, we have already drawn up the concept document for the risk-based approach and the policy document, and we've subjected them to some severe intense legal process, and we have the views on the legal category, legal fraternity on that. We've raised awareness quite intensely, and that's why I'm probably thinking that all of our friends from the Chambers of Commerce and so forth are here, because we've been talking to the various different industry groupings extensively over the last year about the risk-based approach and the implementation of the risk-based approach. We've been there several times as well, and we spoke about the risk-based approach. By the end of April 2016, we did benchmarking of the registration approval systems, and we separated the administrative and the technical processes, as I mentioned earlier. I want to go through it again. And as I said, we're using a system of checklists for now. I want to clarify that this is the manual implementation. We haven't gone into automation just yet. The reason for that, Madam Chair, is very simple. We don't want to go into and develop a system when we haven't actually fine-tuned and peeled out the manual processes. We probably would build a system that is then not responsive to our needs. So we are cleaning up manual systems. Once we're comfortable the manual system actually works, then we can automate the process. Because, as you know, Madam Chair, automating these, bringing in ICT systems means exposure of a lot of resources of the NRC, and we really don't want to do this incorrectly. So this is what I'm talking about now is really a manual approach to it. And as I said, just later in the presentation, we talk about the automation. Then by the end of May 2016, we classified the VCs themselves, the products into the risks. We've got full focus groups. We've got experts in our organization to form focus groups, and they run the classification of the products in terms of those ratings. Thus far, we've identified 100 companies through a purpose of sampling process to do a risk rating on those 100 companies. From those 100 companies, 66 were classified as high risk and 25 were classified as low risk, simply using the compliance history of those companies concerned. We've classified 6 countries of high risk so far, and we've classified 14 of your import clearing agents as high risk. So that's what we've done by the end of May as part of the pilot phase to ensure that when this is fully implemented, we clean out all the creases and bumps that may be a challenge to implementing this approach. By the end of June, we had a phase-in implementation to the risk-based approach. We started with local manufacturers. As I said, it's very easy for us to determine the quality process and the components for the assemblers. For example, your car dealers and so forth, components come from various parts of the world. Assembly takes place here, but there is a very clear quality quality assessment and compliance process here that these companies follow. We've implemented the process for the renewal of the application, as I mentioned, where we simply do the administrative check because the technical check has already been done, provided nothing has changed in the application. Of course, if the components and the type of product has changed, then it's no longer a renewal application. There's been some change in the application. So the low-risk products, we've compiled the administration and technical checks already, and we have brought them into use. By the end of July, we have fully implemented the risk-based approach to renewals itself. We fully implemented the risk-based approach for low-risk products mentioned on the risk assessments that we already conducted. And then the pilot risk-based approach to the medium-risk products in terms of the categorization that we have done. And we had gone one step further. We've also, as I mentioned previously, adopted a risk-based approach to our surveillance activities as well, especially at the Port of Entry. Because I have not spoken about this previously, let me just spend 1 minute. We use a lot of information that is available to us to determine which of the containers and consignments that come into the country, or which of those products that are being manufactured that we want to pay a bit more careful attention to. And we do this by using information from manifests, from information given to us, so that we target only regulated products, and those that are not regulated, and provided we can show ourselves that they're not regulated, we will not normally look at them unless it is, of course, as part of our in-local extended inspections. And where you have higher risk now, we've gone to the risk base, where these products that are coming into the country are being manufactured at the source. Where you have the higher risk nature, we will give more attention to them. That is not to say we're not giving attention to the lower risk products. We will give attention, but as I said, on a less intensive scale. Now, in terms of the manual processes, this is how the system currently works. We have a system called CRM, Customer Relation Management System at the moment, where the early applications are being raised on. So from the CRM, and the CRM gives the applicant a tracking number, which we use to track the progress of the applications. We then do a manual registration of the CRM thereafter, because we need to further process that, and confirm the payment and levy status of the applicant. And here again, the compliance culture for payment of levies needs a lot of attention by ourselves. We will be putting some very intense measures in the near future, bigger in the near future, shorter future, to force the compliance culture of DB pays. Because I think it's becoming quite evident that there's the culture of compliance in terms of leases as well, payments of leases in this country. There's a bit of attention, and we will put in place some very serious measures in short term. Those who are paying the levies and so forth, I mean, we are very appreciative of them. We acknowledge and we take our hats to them, but there's a significant percentage of the people that should be paying the levies for the regulatory work that are not paying this, and we will put some significant, very severe measures in place to force the payments of such levies. After that, we do the administration checks and the assigning of the alloy allocations. So before June, what had happened was that we would do the complete technical evaluation of all applications. And after complete technical evaluation, we go to approval and capturing. That means approving of the alloy and then capturing and issuing. That's the certificate itself. And that took 120 days. And as you've seen earlier, because of some of the capacity challenges and the high volume challenges that we've had, sometimes it exceeded 120 days. But we've put into place measures now to once and for all deal with the challenge. Since June, this is how it now works. Those that fall into the low-risk category, once the analysis of the check is done, we do what is called a technical assessment. And once the technical assessment is done, it goes for approval of capturing and issuing, and we are, of course, targeting 75 days, a maximum of 75 days for this to be done. Those that fall into the medium risk category, there is a technical evaluation. After the administrative check has been done, there will be a limited or a technical evaluation to a certain extent because they are medium risk products. Then it goes in approval of the LOA and capturing an issue, and we are targeting 90 days for this process to be finalized. And then, of course, if it is the high risk category, then we do the full assessment, the administrative check, a full technical assessment, including a technical committee evaluation, approval and capturing issuing, and this we are targeting 128 period for this. I want to emphasize, Madam Chair, that this is all being done manually at the moment. Even the evidence to check and sorting into low, medium, high risk is done manually at the moment. However, we have a plan to go into automation, and this is how the process, what the process will look like in terms of automation. We will have your LOA application system. At the moment, it is CRM. Whether that is going to change in the future will depend on the exploratory project that we have at the moment. From the CRM, there will be in the probably immediate future, we will still continue with the confirmation and the payoff, the payment and legal status. But for now, even though in the next 2 to 3 months, we intend to make the CRM a lot more supportive to our process, the confirmation of payments and legal status will be still be done outside the system, because we are using two different systems. The accounting system is on JD Edwards, and CRM is on Oracle, CBEL-based system, so the interface is not there yet, but we are, of course, working towards bridging that gap as well. However, the CRM system is being adjusted as we speak. I don't want to use the wrong word. I don't think it is being reprogrammed, but there are facilities or features being built into the system for the system to be able to do the admin checks. To give you a simple example, Madam Chair, when an applicant puts in an application into the CRM, by the end of October, middle of November, we anticipate that we'll be able to do this here, depending on the speed with which the company is able to work, but we've targeted by the middle of November to do this. The system would request mandatory information like the test support number, the type of product, the country of origin, and it will have mandatory fields for the test support to be uploaded on the system. The system will do automatic checks like in any other industry environment. If any of the mandatory information is up there, it would prompt the applicant to put in the mandatory information. It would give a certain number of prompts, and once that information has not been uploaded, and the application will be rejected. So it will take away a huge amount of administrative work for us that we're doing right now to ensure that only applications that comply with the administrative requirements are uploaded onto the system. Once the system does that check, then it would be able to sort the applications, because we have databases in terms of the country of origin, in terms of the products, and we are creating the database in terms of the applicants. And I said we've already included 100 companies in the database. So the system will be able to sort the applications into low risk, medium risk, and high risk. Thereafter, they will be captured and sent through, and they'll be assigned to the various different technical evaluation. In terms of the low risk, there's a certain stream that will be followed. In terms of the medium risk, a certain stream will be followed. In terms of the high risk, a certain stream will be followed. I want to re-emphasize that currently it's happening manually. What I'm saying is simply an automation, but we really want to clean up the manual approach to the service. And when the system comes in, all the creases and so forth will be thoroughly ironed out. Of course, we have no doubt that there will be teething problems when the system comes in. We may have to do some adjustments and so forth, but we'll try and keep that to the minimum so that we can have a smooth transition from the manually automated process. So having said all of that, Madam Chair, let's go into the ITT, the automation of the space approach as we have as the policy indicates. In terms of the interventions in the short to medium term, well, in the next 2.5 months, we intend to have improvements into the CRM system, as I said, that will, and I'll talk to what the improvements are going to be. In the long term, which is 8 months targeted towards the end of 2017, we have a project to modernize the entire NRCS, which includes modernizing the Delaware system as well. And I will talk just to the modernization project and the product time management modernization. Now, in terms of short to medium term interventions from an automation point of view, the project was approved and we are currently underway to cater for the risk-based approach on the CRM system. We've appointed the service provider already. We've signed the SLEs and so forth with the service provider. And within the next 4.5 months, starting from August, so it's August, September, October, November. 4.5 months, November, so that's middle of December. So for my apologies, I said middle of November. So 4.5 months, middle of December. So within the next 4.5 months from August 2016, these additional requirements on CRM to cater for this space approach would be in place. The additional requirements on the CRM to cater for the risk-based approach would be implemented on CRM. Middle of December. 4.5 months from August. No, 4.5 months. Is that correct? So it's middle of December. So the new improvements will solve the application by risk rating, as I mentioned, in line with the risk-based strategy, and we will fast-track the lowest applications in a certain process, the medium risk, and then we will focus a lot more attention on the IRIS applications. You would find that this is a sort of degree of penetration approach. The higher the risk, the greater the degree of penetration in terms of the assessment of the applications. And we need to make these adjustments because the CRM system was designed more than 5 years ago, and then we were not doing the risk-based approach. We were not doing the source injection approach, the board enforcement, and so forth. These things came in recently, 2013, and 2012 and 2013. So we really need to include features in our current system to accommodate the risk-based approach as we are modernizing our entire environment. Now, the additional fields that will be deployed on the CRM system in the 4.5 months that we have allocated to that would be country of origin field, the type of application, whether it is a new application or a renewal, then the company type, was it the manufacturer, assembler, or importer, and then the type of the test lab, and the test source. Remember, test labs are accredited either internationally or locally to SANAs, and we'll be able to get those tests if possible, we'll try and get those tests accredited, the test labs accreditation and the test support number. Then the product information is very important, and variations of the product. You can get a cell phone, a BlackBerry, but there could be variations of BlackBerry. There might be a model 8701, another model 8703, and so forth, so we provide for those variations as well. And then we allow for the attachment of compulsory documentations prior to submitting these applications. Now, these are mandatory fields, and non-completion of any of these fields will result in a prompt being given to the applicant, and as I say, after a certain number of prompts, then we'll tell the applicant to please to skip the information and retry the application. In terms of long term, as I said, we have an 18-month window period time frame. By the end of December 2017, we have a project to modernize the entire NRCS environment. In the short term, in progress already, what we've started doing is document all our processes and identify areas of improvement. And you would note that the risk-based approach that we currently are doing is one of the areas of improvement. Then we have a benchmark with similar entities for best practices. One of the entities we would use as a example of good practices across the South African Revenue Services. We've already entered into discussion with the South African Revenue Service. I've engaged personally with the Commissioner, and we already have a project in place in terms of the access codes and the risk engine. So we will benchmark with entities, and of course, as I said, tell you one of those partners that we will benchmark with. Then in the 6 month period, we will do the re-engineering of the processes. After we've documented them, identify the area of improvement, we are going to re-engineer the processes in line with our strategic objectives. Again, Madam Chair, you will recall that our entire approach and our strategy has changed since 2012. We will now have the process support strategy in terms of the new way that we do things. And then by the last 6 months to the 18-month window period that we have, we will then implement an ICT solution. Of course, this will be done in partnership with the service provider. We follow all the rules. We comply with the governance requirements that are necessary in order to get in a partner on board so that we can implement the required solutions to the NRCS. Now, this is what we are doing. At the moment, our current business process is very, very manual. Members of Parliament had this at our offices, and they've seen the huge amounts of paper and so forth that we had to process. And that computer in the beginning, I was told, is an old computer, so therefore it's an old process. I'm not sure if the battery explodes there, but it's an old computer. And left a lot of more manual processing, and this is what the members saw in the office of Mr. Gnile, all this. And then we had manual certificates and contact support. That means we had to really have personal contact to we emphasize is also is a lot more modern, fully more automated online system, policy-based approval. That means the rules will be put into the system, and the system will be able to do a lot of the work for us in terms of the sorting and so forth. But of course, the evaluation itself has to be done by an evaluator. And then we go into the e-certificate process, where the certificate will be processed electronically, and we don't have to give a field certificate to anybody. We'll have safety features on the certificate, and this will be communicated by electronic means to the applicants. And of course, we are looking at a knowledge-based support. So the concept of call centers comes to mind, whereby we'd be able to give support to the industry on a remote basis rather than on a personal contact basis. Of course, we are going to make it possible as well through this ICT modernization project for levies to be paid online, like in most other industries. You know, if you bought an air ticket from any of the airlines, you pay immediately using a credit card. We will find, look at certain approaches to making it possible to pay these levies online. And I mean, the benefits around all of this would be reducing our paper and cost and printing costs, time costs. You know, yes, and dealing with our corporate orders as well, and also of course making it less inconvenient for industry to comply with our requirements and more positive in its approach. And then of course we'll be able to conduct a lot of smart audits based on our intelligence that we have. And this will all lead to fast-tracking our issuance arrays, being able to do our surveillance work a lot more effectively, and of course collecting, very importantly, all the money that is due to us so that we can grow as an organization and attend to the qualification, which is based really on the collection of monies. So, Madam Chair, in terms of the risk-based approach, that is what I want to present to the Parliament today. This is the list of abbreviations and acronyms, and I'm not sure if you want me to stop here or continue with the presentation. Thank you.
Just a minute. I thought it was very helpful, and thank you very much for that presentation smoothly. But you said this, the list of abbreviations. We had to do our Earth search just now for a POE, which is, well, certainly not Edgar Allan Poe. It's the Ethernet. Now, I must say, the Ethernet just explains that it's the first switches.
POE is part of entry. Yeah, I'm apologizing. We'll include that. Sorry.
And on that note, members, I think to let's at least deal with this part of the process, I will correct. I'd like the hands at the back to be a bit higher so that I can see them. I'm awfully sorry. Yes, Honourable Albert, Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Kurinoff, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Williams. I think I've mentioned you have our Honourable Colonel tonight. In that order, please. And the time, shall we say, to start with, just be succinct. It's time to stick to 3 minutes. At the outside, 3.5. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just have one question. Yes, made a present presentation regarding the systems going forward to ensure that there are approvals in place and compulsory specifications are complied with. My question actually falls or deals with matters or objects, products that fall outside compulsory specifications. I've heard that you mentioned here there are 18. I think 18 in total that you're monitoring compulsory specifications. As the law stands at the moment, if anything comes into the country where there's no compulsory specification, anybody can do anything with it without any legal responsibility, basically. So if anybody imports paraffin products that's a little bit different than the ones that you have to comply with and falls outside the compulsory specifications, then most people can, irrespective of what happens with people who use it, the product, whether it explodes or whatever it may be, actually still sell it. And I want to know how you deal with that. There are many such products, and we live in an age where products are developed so fast and so quickly that you actually need generic type of compulsory specification, you call that. I want to know how you deal with that, because you're looking at specific product based, specific compulsory compulsory of compulsory specifications, which leaves huge gaps in the market going forward. And if I read the Act properly, then the Act allows for that, and that's just it's not acceptable. So we need to find a way where you can create an umbrella of some sort where you actually cover every single product that comes into this country and make sure that they are specifications for them, whether they're generic or whether they visually are product specific. But I feel that there's a huge gap as far as that is concerned, and I'd like to know how you will deal with that going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Elvis. I'll just check Honourable Esther Hazen.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Woodley. Somehow after working relationship with SABS, because the point of working in a relationship was to only benefit the industry. Before, back in the day, the SABS was very formally accepted by all South African end users as a sign of reliability. That's because I was just mentioning products closed, and that's more than electrical. The SAB Technical Committee has accepted IEC, or electrical components, the specification to attempt to remove barriers of trade. And that means that there's no control over substandard imports. SABS, for one, are funded by compulsory levies. The local industries hope that the controlling bodies such as the NRC and the SABS would regulate the importation of such products. And presently, there's a reduced presence in the market, and there's serious doubts about the effectiveness of the policy specifications and regulations. A lot of switchgear and isolated stuff may be carried a mark, but it doesn't even switch on or off at a specified amp set on an isolator, for example. Which can then explode. Maybe lastly, why does the SABR mark bearing product also require letters of authority, and why are those products also subject to a compulsory levy in addition to the SABS permit fees? This places an increased financial burden on the manufacturer. Thank you, Dave.
Very much, Honourable Esther Hazen. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Moody. I'm actually honest with you, sitting here for the first time with the NRCS, I feel like I kind of want to break into applause. I must be right. It's an impressive presentation, and it's by far the most progress that we've seen from the NRCS in over 18 months fighting about this. And I suppose my regret is that it seems like we had to have those arguments for so long to get to where we are today. But nevertheless, I think that if we can, in the course of the next few months and 12 months, implement the system that you've outlined today with as minimum implementation hiccups as possible, we will have a really great system in place that we can be very proud of. I do still have another specific question, and let me run through them quickly. Firstly, you have committed to specific deadlines for the automation and for the implementation of the new CRS system. Can we just have a specific deadline for when customers can know that the new RBA system is totally operational and that low-risk customers will be dealt with in 75 calendar days? I think we must commit to a specific deadline on that. And then when you commit to a deadline of the end of next year for the modernization of the ICT system, I think that December 2018 needs to be when all of the hiccups and teething problems are sorted out and the system is fully operational. We can't only go live in December 2018 and then you still have three to six months of hiccups and teething problems. I think we must go into a test phase late next year, test it for 3 to 6 months, iron out all the problems, do the redesign, and then it goes live with everything sorted out in December. Are we going to inform customers of their risk status so that they have incentive to lower their risk rating? I would like customers to know that they are rated high risk. Maybe they can have a big red sign on when they interact with the system online so that they can know what they need to do to become low risk. Thirdly, I presume that the DTI's paid lawyers have looked at the policy. Is it going to be legal for us to discriminate between countries on the basis of risk status? I hope that's not in contravention of any WTO MFIN requirements. Then I just want to mention something about India. Look, as I said at the beginning, I'm thrilled with the 75-day commitment. I think that's a huge step in the right direction. Once we get to 75 days, we can't rest on our laurels because then the committee is going to put pressure on you to make 70 days and 65 and so on. That's how we work. It's a nice step of improvement. But it was mentioned in this committee in a previous meeting that India takes much longer than us. And I went and checked that. I went and did research. And funnily enough, India just went live with a fully automated system on the 5th of July. It's a lot, less than 2 months ago. And they are now dealing with low-risk applications in 31 calendar days with a fully online automated system. So I think we still have a long way to go, but if we can get to 75 days, that would be a huge step in the right direction. Then the 75 days... Is that going to decrease automatically when the system goes live in December 2017? Because I can understand why it should take 75 days for low risk under manual system. I can completely have sympathy with that. But surely when the entire system is automated, we've worked out all of the kinks, we can get to less than 75 days on a fully automated system. Then finally, in this round, I see no mention of what we discussed in the past about pre-import certification. And does your automated system envisage allowing for that? And can you give us the details? Thank you.
I also want to welcome the presentation. From the NCRS. I have a number of questions in this. One of them is the usage of concepts that are overlapping to each other is very important. Because now you speak about the source of the product that helps you to understand the risks of a product and the company. In the very same presentation, you speak about the country of origin. Because if we are going to talk about a country of origin, it could be the source of the product from that particular country. So maybe that is why you gave us three categories: the company, the product, and the country. So I just like the relationships between the source of the product and the country of origin. Two. You think that you are looking at companies based on the history of compliance. And secondly, you raise the question of voluntary participation in the company's participation in a self-compliance scheme. I'm worried about this. I'm not sure how we're going to monitor this thing. This matter of the history of the applicant. Because they are companies that perhaps might have such history of compliance and then we just give them a certificate. But to find that the product is a problem. There was an issue of the emission of the cars. That they entered countries when they were investigated in the United States of America. They found that they were not compliant. And they were complicated. They were here in South Africa. There are a number of big companies, for cars, if you go to Japan, and they are here running here in the Republic of South Africa, and then we find that the airbags are not functioning well. That airbag is found perhaps in Germany, but they are operating here in South Africa. So this history of compliance in relation to technocracies that we can find, what do we mean with that?
I also want you to look at your examples of risk calculation on slide 15. In that slide 15, if you look at number 4 and number 10, both risk rating is at 30. But in terms of the colors, one is red, which is high risk, and the one is yellow, which is amber, and medium, low risk. Why do you have same numbers but the different levels? Look at number 4, it's 13, it's yellow, and then you look at number 10, it's also 13, but it's red. Well, what is the implication about why that is the case? And then I think at slide 12, I spoke about those risk factors. At slide 12, the last question is slide 12. Okay. Your slide 12 speak about common risk factor. And then you outline the set judgments, history against somebody, NRA, CS registration, CS registration. I don't see why don't you put South African Pro Standard. Are we not looking at whether in terms of the South African Pro Standard those people are complying in terms of everything? So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mukongi. Then we have Honorable Kuenho.
Thank you, Chairperson. The bad thing about a presentation like this is that you will be severely judged on it. So just be aware of that. But thank you very much. I must agree, I think there is some progress. Just your first slide on the number of compulsory specifications for, you know, to get in the NLOA. It went up from 4 to 18. Why? And who determines that it will go up to 18? And will it remain at 18, or will it go up further, or will it? Is there a chance that it will drop?
Was that quick, right? Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you, Mr. Mdee. I will join my colleagues in certainly applauding you for the presentation that's been put on the table. I think it's, as you've said, a long time coming. But I think it's a very good lesson to certainly the DCI and every entity that interacts with business and the economy, that you can never be behind the curve and trying to play catch-up to where the market is going, but rather be ahead of the curve, because quite frankly, we should never have gotten into this place in the first instance. I think we all recognize the need for regulation to protect consumers, but not to the point where, you know, we started suffocating business to the extent that we did. But be that as it may, I think there's some positives, and that's what we have to look forward to. I would just like to just ask a couple of questions, Mr. Moody, because with respect to the average delays, and I'm glad that we have a picture of what those delays are, and I think that they are substantial in my view, over the 120-day mark. I'd still be interested to understand what the backlog is between 100 and 120 days, because I suspect that there's a number of applications that are allowed to really get pushed out to the maximum period when I don't believe that there really is a need for them to do so. If you could provide that to us, and I think I'd just like one more category to be provided there. With respect to the your determination of country risk factors, can you explain to me why the volume or value of a consignment flat is a risk factor when you do your calculation? On page 14, or page 15, would the time for an application to be processed, whether it was category 1 or category 6, both in a low risk determination, would those both be 75 days? Or if it is at a one, would that be sort of, you know, after said working days? Or will you treat both of the same, even though one is potentially higher risk, even though they are both in the low risk category? If you could just explain to me, is there varying approval periods even in the subcategories themselves? I have said before, and I still think it's something that you need to discuss with the industry, that if resources are a challenge, I think that industry, and I don't speak on their behalf as much as some of my colleagues might think that I do, that they would be open to a potential premium levy if they wanted to subject themselves to the system, or if people wanted to go through the normal system, you know, and wait 120 calendar days, they could. But I certainly believe that industry would look to work with you on a, on a levy premium if it meant getting the system up and running quicker, because it would allow turnaround for their systems to stay quicker. Other companies, countries, and the freight forwarding agents, the 100 that you've already identified, have they been informed of their status at the moment? And is there an appeal process or an appeal mechanism if they feel that they've been unfairly classified? And then I think the Honourable Hill Lewis has already asked a question on you know, how they work up to it. I've got two more questions. Will the applicants be able to view the status of their application online so they can see where it is in process? And then finally, you mentioned the need for this obviously to become a policy. Has that policy been submitted to the minister or to the DTI? And can you proceed on the trial period if that policy has not been submitted or approved as yet? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to also welcome the report and congratulate you for this. It's a real big leap, you know, it's really good. I just have one question. I just want to know, a new product arrives imported by a new company, they would automatically become high risk. How would they then move to be low risk, or the other way around? Maybe you've got an existing company with a product, but you find a problem with that product, they've moved to high risk. So I just want to know if there is a process, and what is that process for companies to move up and down the risk, the scale? Thank you.
I do have one or two comments myself, Ms. Moodley. You referred to the CRM system. Okay, you noted that it would be quite costly. Has the costs of the system been factored into the medium-term expenditure budget? The other thing is the levy program and the payments, which the Auditor General also referred to, and in the end there was some difference of opinion as to what this was. But I was just wondering now, as this will also address the levy collection issues, you know, you should consider fully using the levy payment factor now, that makes sense, as this would also address levy collection issues identified by the AG. You also referred to some of the challenges in the manual system, which the automated system you project to see overcoming. But while this is still there, how does this risk-based approach work in practice? And I assume that this won't happen overnight, this transfer to the automated system. What measures have you got in place to address the issues as they arise? The other point that I want to raise with respect to days, others have referred to it, we have been complimented by members of the committee and really addressing this constructively. But I'm looking at the 75 days of Petra. Now, I am aware, having seen these, that there are numerous applications with respect to computer systems, etc., printers, which are way, way over what is called even 120 days, and one wouldn't have thought, judging from the presentation, that these would be considered high risk. But on the country specified, one wouldn't have thought that this would be identified as high risk. We're looking at 180 days, 200 days. There is a problem there. And perhaps all of those that are over 160 days, you should make the committee aware of these so you can share with us the problems that you are experiencing, one. And with respect to the country, a member of the committee did indicate that they would assume your risk-based approach complies with the WTO and other international legal requirements. So on that basis, what in the company risk profile identifies a country? What criteria are you looking at that would say this would make this a high-risk country? Because by having said that, it concerns me, considering we've had the whole banana issue where all of the province was just banned because of one little spot and one case of bananas. So I just want to get to the bottom of this criteria, please. But I must concur with members of the committee that this has been a very constructive presentation, although there are still issues that remain outstanding. Now, take your time. I'm sure now your blood pressure has dropped, so you address us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We'll address all of the questions here, with the sole exception of the one from Honourable McPherson, which will provide in the writing. But I have the technical specialists with me, and cost containment measures dictate that they cannot come to Cape Town without doing some work. So I will allow them to answer some questions as well. Honourable Helvis, products that fall outside the compulsory specifications in total 80. Just to say that for point of information, the 18 specifications that we are referring to here is specifically for the electrotechnical environment. We focused on the electrotechnical environment today, but recall that we have other areas that we work with, the automotive, chemicals, materials and mechanical, even metrology, we have foods and associated, so there's a number of specifications. This 18 specifically deals with the electrotechnical. Now, then the need for a generic type of of compulsory specifications will deal with that. Product base will also deal with that. In terms of the working relationship with FABs, I'll deal with that. In terms of the accepted by the IEC standards and the barriers to trade, I think they will get Mr. Kamir to answer that question. No control over such substance products, I'll deal with that. Our reduced presence in the market, I will deal with that.
Why does SAPS mark LA and require levies? I can deal with that, but I think I'll leave that to the CFO to speak around that. In terms of the next few months' implementation requiring minimum problems, I will ask the CIO to deal with all questions around the system. I'm going to ask the CIO to deal with that. Our commitment to the specific deadlines. The specific deadlines for the new RPA to be fully operational, I'm going to ask Kongani and Lance to deal with that. They can decide amongst themselves. In terms of the December 2017 deadline, where all the hiccups and teething problems to be sorted out and we actually go live in December 2017, I'm going to ask the CIO to deal with that as well. Are we going to inform customers of those status? Kongani will deal with that. Self-compliance issues, I will ask Kongani to deal with that. The policy, is it legal to discriminate between countries? With regard to the policy matters, there were three questions around that. Is it legal to discriminate? Has the policy been approved? Does it comply with the WTO? Dr. Boho, our senior manager legal here, she will deal with those questions. In terms of World 75 days disease automatically, I will give you an answer on that one. Pre-import certification, I can deal with that, but if Bongani thinks he's more competent, he's quite comfortable to deal with that. But of course, I'm quite happy to deal with that as well. Bongani is more competent to deal with that. Pre-import, it's a COC. Okay. Then, thanks very much. The usage of concepts that are overlapping source of products help us to understand the source versus the country of origin. Again, I will ask Hans to deal with that. The history of compliance and voluntary participation in self-compliance scheme, I will deal with that one. The issue, especially, and then the, for example, Honorable Tong used the example of the cars and the emissions. I'll deal with that one. Number 4 and number 10, in terms of the risk rating, I'm going to ask Lance to do that. Why is one in red and the other in yellow? Okay. Then 5 out of the judgments, history, self-registration marks, I'm going to ask Smoker to deal with that one in terms of the current history. In just in terms of the status registration, I think we can very easily answer that question that we do take into consideration status as test laboratory. Recall that we have to work with all test laboratories. We do not give referential treatment to any test laboratory. We do take the status test report as one of the documents, one of the approved documents, because status is an accredited test laboratory. So if a test report that comes from status, we look at it, and if it is fully compliant to the specifications, then we consider that as well. Honorable Kunov asked on why 4 to 18 and will this go up or remain or will this candles come down? I'm going to give that to Bongani as the specialist in that area to deal with it. With regard to the Honorable McPherson, yes, I've spoken about between 100 and 120 days. We'll provide those statistics in writing. The value of assignments as a risk factor, Lance will deal with that. Mariano, with regard to slide 515, category 1 to 6, both 75 days, if one is in category based application is category 1, the block 1, and another one is in block 6, both low risk, would we allocate the same approach to it, Lance and Bongani will answer that. If resources are challenging in the industry, would it be open, can we record it as part of the Minister of Media? So then we will approach industry to give us more money. Have the risks been informed, have the companies been informed of the risk status and what are the appeals process? I will deal with that, and Bongani and Lance would assist me on that. Can you view the status of application online? Mandla will deal with that, Mandla Makita, our CIO. As a policy is submitted to the minister and it has not been submitted to the minister, can we deal with it? I think Tabokka will deal with that. You know, it takes a vulnerable woman, new product automation high risk, and how does it go to move automatically new product high risk, how do we go to new low risk, and converse of that, how many is going to deal with that one. Let me share in terms of the CRM system as the cost being budget affected to the medium term, CFO is here, she will tell us about that. The levy payments and collection issues, the CFO will tell us about that to get assisted by Mandla. While the manual system is in play, how does the RBA work? Bongani is going to deal with that together with assistance from Lance. Transform the RBA to automation, the measures to address all the issues, Mandla is going to deal with that together with assistance from Bongani. And then there's numerous applications that are in excess of 120 days. We should inform the committee of all applications that are over 160 days. Madam Chair, we will do that. But as I said, we are putting in place short-term immediate measures in September and October to bring it back. In fact, the plan is that by the end of October, there will be no application that is. And there will be no application that is exceeding 120 days. Okay? Remember, we've increased our capacity in that unit by 150%. And then assume that our RBA complies with the World Trade Organization requirements, risk for a category. The first one, Tabokka will answer that whether it complies with the risk with World Trade Organization requirements, and then the risk for the country, what criteria will determine the risk for the country, I think we will ask the Lance to do that. So,
just before the team, as it were, in the finals, let us bring for a little bit of tea. It will also allow you to ensure that this team knows what they're about. And that is fantastic, you know, example of delegation. Thank you. Right. A short break. It's tea. It's water. There's the odd yogurt makers. If you can rest to it. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next slide.
Into a huddle.
Thank you.
We need to get back and some short, sharp responses because I wasn't sure exactly how the meeting would progress. I had already ordered a transcript. I'm saying this for the benefit of members and, of course, the NRCS, so that you'll have that there, and I think we'll get it in about a week. And then, that being the case, what remains outstanding, and you'll be able to see that from your responses, you can add to it writing. I hope I'm quite clear. We still have the annual report. At the same time, as I said, members have signed. Have all members signed? Very kind, very kind, yes. Where's Miss Sass again? Well, we could always go and, relocate, but there we are, Gigi.
I think the others will stop already, and we have said that brevity will be the word.
I'll put the feedback on the financial information. First question with regard to the payment of levies and the SADS mark. The levy payments are a law requirement in terms of the NRSS Act, so that is why those payments are due. The second question in respect of whether the SADS system will be funded, we fund our CAPEX expenditure out of cash, so we do have cash reserves from which to fund the CRM system, so the answer is yes. And final question in respect of the, or comment in with regard to the comfort that we'll gain in respect of our qualification if systems are implemented, the answer is yes as well. It will assist in resolving our qualification.
Okay. As you saw me, you, that was the CFO, and then your name then, sir.
Okay. My name is Bongani Tamile, I'm the General Manager, Electrotechnical. Okay, I've got a few questions to respond to. I mean, if some, so I think I will be assisted if I listen. Okay. First was a question about whether the 10 companies that we have selected on the pilot have been informed of their status, as well as whether we intend to inform them going forward. Okay, as you well aware, we have indicated that that was a pilot, so it was an internal exercise. And after doing that exercise, we assessed the results, we've made some changes, so it was not proper at that stage to inform them. However, going forward, we intend to make sure that the customers are being informed of their status and what is it that they need to do in order to improve their status. We CEO indicated also that this is every 6 months we will be reviewing the status on the basis of the product, the country, and the company itself. The next question is on the self-compliance. Firstly, it should be remembered that the responsibility to comply with the regulation lies with the manufacturer and the importer. Okay. Whoever participates in the industry, whether it's a distributor, has a responsibility to comply. Now, what has been the issue now is that companies are importing, most of the products are imported into the country. So they tend to come meeting the requirements of other countries rather than South African requirements. So companies have been indicated that they are not too sure exactly what to comply with. So what we are now doing to say, you must make sure that you understand the requirements of South Africa. And if there are any problems, you have means to recall the product or to keep the product up until we can come and do the test and inspect the product to show that it complies. Now, this problem will involve training of the personnel from those entities who want to participate. And also sometimes if there are international committees which talk about the products that they sell, we jointly we can form part of those committees so that we can also influence the regulations and international regulation that is important for this country. Now on the certificate of compliance, the COC. The challenge that we always have is that the LOA that we issue is based on one sample. So now this sample represents volumes and volumes of the product that will be coming to the country for a period of 3 years, and thereafter you renew that LOA. Now what has been happening, you would find that applicants will bring a product that complies with all the specifications for approval. We issue the approval, but what the volumes that tends to come, the other consignment do not comply. that's the golden product concept is that we are having a transient. So the COC would help us with that, in that before you send the application, a NRCS recognized conformity assessment body will go out and sample from the confinement that is ready to come to the standards. They will test and then they will issue the certificate. Whatever comes to our shores, we will be sure that it complies with our requirement based on the certificate that will be issued by the conformity assessment body that we would have recognized. Now, this would not only help us from the technical in terms of compliance, it will also help us with the figures, because before the confinement comes to the country, we will know exactly the volumes that we are getting. So it will help with the issue of the AG findings as well. So that how the system will work. We have to recognize the conformity assessment bodies, we have to train it on our requirements, and then they will have to issue the certificate, which we will rely on over and above the test report. There was a question about the number of VCs. As in fact, we're currently regulating 18, but they are growing, unfortunately. Next year, our team, they are working on two of the VCs that will be promulgated next financial year. One of them is the portable generators, which this committee also recommended that we should regulate that. It's ready to be submitted to DTI and it will be out for comments. There's also LED VC, which might be coming next year or year after, and that one will bring quite a lot of applications because the direction now is moving towards LED. So yes, they will be growing in the future. I think I've covered for now, unless there's maybe one or two that I've missed. Thanks.
Thank you. The name is Lancelot Triano. I'm a technical specialist at NRVS. I will address some of the questions which are listed here. First, in terms of the factors we have used for our risk-based approach, product, country, and company factors, there is a question on the value of consignment with respect to the country. If you notice there, we have got volume or value of consignment of the product. From where we are sitting, this, the value gives us a sense of the quantities of the product. And specifically, if it's large volumes of products, that will impact, if it's high-risk products, that will definitely give us a sense of the impact as well. So it is in that sense that we put value or volume. It's really the volume, but a value can also make you inquire about the volume. Then also just to general comment, in terms of those factors which have been listed under each of the variables of country, product, and company, the first line of factors, the compliance history, that is what the model is currently based on. We are saying all of those factors represent an array of factors which can be used to quantify the risk with respect to any of those variables. But NRCS, for now, we are using the compliance history. Then there is a question in terms of you get two products, or scenarios rather. One is on the lower end of the risk, the other is on the top end. One is a 1, the other is a 6. Are they going to be treated differently? For our entry level model, it's no. Those two scenarios are classified as low risk and they will be treated the same. I'm saying for our entry level model, maybe as we go on, we may begin to look at it, especially when we get self-compliance and the COC in combination with that. But for the entry level, same treatment, they are all low risk. Then we got also a question in terms of the factors which have been used, the definitions, the terms, where it was mentioned, source. Just to look at source, there are two applications for the source in terms of NRFS. There is source, this is for internal purposes for NRFS with respect to where we inspect, when we do our market surveillance inspections, we define a source as an importer. In other words, we are already looking within the border of South Africa. An importer, the port of entry, and a manufacturer. We define those as source for our market surveillance or operational activities. Then there is a source which can be interchanged with a country of origin. We are applying that outside the borders. So there are two applications. In this case, we are mainly, I think source was referring to within the borders of South Africa where we do our inspection. Outside the border, source is where the product really comes from. Then there was a question on the risk matrix there in terms of various combinations. We've got a combination, two combinations which yield a risk rating of 18. One comes from a very high risk product scenario combined with a very low risk company and a very low risk country of origin. You get 18. Then the other comes from a very low risk product on the lower end combined with the highest end of a company risk, a very high risk company, and a very high risk country of origin, and you get 13. You will notice there, if you look at 10 and 4, on 4 we say medium high, on 10 we say high medium. There we are trying to show the borderline cases. There are borderline cases. As much as we have defined our tolerance levels as 1 to 12, but there are certain borderline cases which may lead us to even think further, especially when we bring in the combination of the other factors which can give us comfort, such as your COC and so on. But on a mathematical basis, this is what it is. It's high medium or medium high. It's also to illustrate a point that there are those borderline cases which we hope will be taken care of by other interventions.
I think those are the questions I can see.
My name is Nandam Kavela, CIO NRCS. I'm going to deal with the IG related questions. On the issue of the 75 days improvement. Basically, when we implement IT system, we seek to achieve efficiency. So we definitely seeking to be efficient going forward. So what will happen is that we cannot promise the days, but when we implement the system, we'll definitely be efficient. We anticipate we will be doing application quicker than the way we're doing manually now. Okay. On the issue of, I think the honorable member mentioned the issue of India. We have noted that. We're going to look at it. And we're busy with some benchmarking exercises, like looking at the European Union. And India also will be one of the key areas that we look at, because we don't want to go and reinvent the wheel, basically. We're going to look at what other people are doing out there, and then we bring it back. And it will make us implement the system quicker rather than trying to do it on our side. On the issue of view the status of application, this will allow you to view the status of the application and track it from in application to approval. We also, on top of that, not only is the clients going to be able to view the application, but we're going to be implementing a notification rule whereby where there's changes, we're going to be able to send notification to the client without them asking for information. So they're going to be notified. So they don't have to log into the system to see the status. So we're going to, as we work internally, we're going to send them via their SMS, via email, so they're going to know exactly where the status of the application. The last one, I think it was talking about the issue of the 18 months, whether we're going to capture the issue of testing and hang out all the creases. We have set up that. So we adopted a phased approach we're going to be doing it on a phased approach and making sure that before the 18 months, we have tested everything and then we show it's working. Thank you.
My name is Soha Pai. I'm the Senior Manager in Legal Services. And in relation to the policy, the CEO is, at the accounting authority, is the person who approves the policy, and he has signed off on that draft policy. And then in regards to the WTO question, the attorneys have reviewed the policy, and they haven't raised any issues in respect of that. We are, though, subjecting the entire methodology to legal scrutiny at the moment. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thanks very much. Those were the questions, and just a few things on my side. One, the first one I'll deal with is the relationship with SAPS. But if you recall that Lianosius was previously the regulatory of the SAPS, so there is a close relationship between SAPS and ourselves. However, SAPS is a service provider to the NRCS. They provide testing services, and also they are responsible for the product and the national standards, and we participate in the technical committees. And where the national standards have a safety physical aspect to them, then we translate that into composite specifications. So there is a bigger than normal relationship with SAPS as far as the national standards and the technical committees and so forth are concerned. And I believe that we have a very cordial relationship because we participate in all the committees, and in some of the committees, the NRCS also chairs these committees. I can just give you the example of something in the automotive sector. The current process to deal with the pre-owned tires and so forth, the NRCS is chairing the committee, so we have a very close relationship as far as that is concerned. But in terms of SAPS being a service provider, we treat SAPS as a treat with every other testing house. And we do hospital to set testing services on our behalf, and we do accept test reports from the SAPS. As far as the SAPS financial model is concerned, I think they'll be in a better place to explain that. But I'm not aware that there's a levy model that they follow. I do know that they charge a certain amount of money for services rendered. And the SAPS mark is issued when the product or the applicant complies with all these standards. That is a voluntary requirement. The compulsory specification is as it is, it's compulsory, and the applicant must prove that indeed they comply with the 50 critical aspects of it. So normally a person will receive a SAPS mark, would be issued with a SAPS test report that would show compliance, and we'll place reliance on that SAPS test report. And in case of Honourable Herbert, I promise to give you an answer on those products that follow the compulsory specifications. Where there is no specification or regulation, then of course we can't hold a product against a compulsory specification. You're quite right. And that is a serious gap in the marketplace, that indeed a non-compliant, a very dangerous product can enter the marketplace, and because there is no regulation, there is no specification, that indeed it can be traded and it can cause catastrophic damage to consumers and environment. In that case, what we are appealing to all our partners is bring it to our attention, because in terms of Section 22 of the Legal Methodology Act, the CEO of the NRCS can implement interim measures to deal with a situation whilst the regulations are being drafted and being signed up by the Minister. No, but the regulation must be signed up by the Minister of Trade and Industry. Otherwise, it would be illegal. However, in the interim, if it is of such a critical nature that absence of regulations will create untold damage and harm to the consumer and the environment, then the Legal Methodology Act allows that interim intervention by the CEO. In the specific case that has been brought to our attention, interim measurements have been drafted, and we are in the process of finalizing those. But we'd appreciate that if it's brought to our attention. We, of course, do our own market scans. We have the technical people, the professionals who do their own market scans. Parliament brings to our attention quite a bit of those products, like the generators were brought to our attention last year. The pre-owned second-hand tires also were brought to our attention. These products can cause a lot of trouble in the environment, and we are in the process of dealing with them. So, indeed, the short answer is that, indeed, if there are no compulsory specifications, there are no regulations, if it is a dangerous product, yes, it can be traded. We can't charge the people for trading because we don't have any measure against it. It's like where a law doesn't exist, there's nothing you can do. You can't enforce a law that doesn't exist. And then, but we would, of course, we would welcome any
information in this regard we can take for. But Kevin Chair, we've generally dealt with the category and looking at questions in that manner, and the questions that are actually in response, and there will certainly be resources to get back to you. Thank you very much.
Now, members, I'm hoping this is going to be put in writing. We've got the annual report, but I would like to note it on record. Thank you. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I just think it's important to understand, and I didn't get a clear response on is there a subcategory in the risk model? So if you are a 1, would you be subjected to the full 75 days? Because I mean, that just doesn't make sense. If it can be processed in 20 days, it should be processed in 20 days. I mean, obviously, it's a non-risk item. Therefore, it should not have to be subjected to the full 70 days. I'll ask if the NRCS really apply their mind to categories within or subcategories in categories, because I just think that it has the potential for something to be quite simple to start further complicating it and going back into that place along the ledge when it's not necessary to happen.
I think the point you've made is valid, because the goal, as one of you pointed out, one of the members, one wants to try and reduce 75 days across the board. But it's not going to happen tomorrow, but you have asked for the identification of other categories which may assist on the journey to achieving the actual target. Now, members, as I indicated, we are getting a transcript. This is an important meeting. And from that transcript, we'll be able to do further clarifications or raise questions if need be. Are we agreed? Right. So on that basis, then, we're now going to shift. And I must say, now, look, this is a way you have to sort of really try and get to this point quicker with all of the entities. So we're now on the annual report, as well as the first quarter, financial and non-financial, by the NRDS on a 2015-2016 annual report. So, everyone ready for that? And at this moment, prior to Mr. Asik and Mr. Ugly speaking, can I just acknowledge that we do have with us the European Union Chamber of Commerce. We've also got the American Chamber of Commerce with us. We also have the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. We've also got South African Association of Freight Forwarders, etc. And what is the team leader? Hillebrand? What is this? J.F. Hillebello. What's that? Who's the person? Giselle. Well, what's the name of the company? It's just Oh, it's a freight forwarder. Yeah, just so we get some idea. I thought with Giselle you may be on the stage with ballet. Right. Right. Over to yourself, CEO. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. So we'll do both the presentations together with your permission, if that's okay. The annual report and the first quarter performance for 2016-17. So basically it's the same thing. I'll very quickly go over strategic overview, and then I'll go a little bit more with the performance against targets, both non-financial and financial, and then the CFO will deal with the audit reports in both of the presentations. So, Chairperson, I think it's clear now that our mandate is really simple. We've discussed this so many times. To protect the consumer and the environment from unsafe, substandard, non-compliant products, to promote fair trade, and to promote the uniform understanding of the building regulations and building standards.
You want to pass your
arms? Thank you very much. And then to do that, we have four strategic objectives, four strategic priorities. The first is to develop, maintain, and address the composite specification of technical variations. That's simply where there are standards. We will utilize the safety critical aspects of standards.
where they are none, we will put in place interim measures whilst the regulations are being tested. Then the other principal area of priority is to maximize compliance with our specification, and this is really to go with our surveillance work. And as I mentioned previously, we have a two-pronged approach to this. This is pre-market approval, and that's basically what we've been discussing for the last 2.5 hours, 3 hours. That's the LOA process. And then market surveillance, which is to go out to the marketplace, cost of entry, manufacturers to determine or to ensure that products comply with the requirements. Then we also have a priority to inform and educate our stakeholders, and our annual plan will show that. And of course, we have a capacity and organization that can support the study priorities. Our vision is to be a credible and respected regulator for the work that we do in terms of our mandate and not any other purpose, and to protect the public, the economy and the environment, and then to develop composite specifications, ethical regulations, and maximize compliance in terms of the mission of achieving that vision. Now, our mandate comes from the Acts, and we've dealt with the Acts before. The sectors that we are involved in, automotive sector, as I mentioned, friction material, brake fluids and so forth, chemicals, materials, and mechanicals, these, you know, cement, tobacco, detergents, also protective equipment, etc. Electrotechnical, which we've been discussing for the great part of this morning. Foods and associated industries, these are fishery products, canned meat, processed meat, and then legal methodology is everything to do with measuring, waste measurements, and the labeling. And then, of course, the building regulations is the interpretation and the application of the building regulations and building status act. Now, the actual performance, just the hierarchy, as before we go to the actual table, is that during the last financial year, non-compliance products to the value of 204 million rand were removed from the marketplace. 106 million was basically because of non-compliance with the legal authority act itself. And this is changing the consumer. I used the example previously where a packet of noodles is supposed to be 2 grams and you get 1.8 grams in it. Now, of course, that's not acceptable, and we normally ask the dealer in that product to either correct it, but if it's not possible to correct it, we either return back to the country of origin, or we then ask them to destroy it. We conducted 50,000 inspections in the 2015-16 financial year. We've issued 80,825 approvals, that is because from the NRCS as a whole, in electrotechnical, automotive, health guarantees from the FAI, and in the automotive sector as well. And we developed the Vision 2020, where we want to be in terms of our strategic projection for the 5 year of 2020. In terms of our strategic goal number one, which is to develop, maintain, and administer compulsory specifications, we developed, withdrew, and meant 8 out of 10 compulsory specifications, which means we did not do 2. The variance was the 2 that we did not do. One was because of a failure to agree with stakeholders and the disease. And of course, in terms of that, was also poor participation in the development of the compulsory specification. And Madam Chair, the consultation with our with the stakeholders is critical for us to be able to finalize a compulsory specification. And where this doesn't take place, of course, it's evidence that we have to go into further participation process, further stakeholder consultations before we can finalize the process. Whereas we try to keep this within our control by having scheduled meetings and so forth, sometimes this does not occur. 2 technical papers were developed and approved for this by the CEO, this is in accordance with the requirements, and 100% of all the review board decisions in terms of the national building regulations were finalized within the 37 days from the date that the review board set, and these decisions were then issued to the respective persons. Then to maximize compliance with all the compulsory specifications and technical regulations. The automotive sector gave 3,744 inspections against a total of 4,000. That means there was a variance of 6%. 2,623 of this was at source. 1,921 was at retail. Now, at this stage, Madam Chair, I'd like to make comments to say that you would recall that we've started a new approach to our inspection and surveillance using source space and so forth. So we did set ourselves what we call stretch, ambitious stretch targets. And we of course wanted to see how far we could stretch ourselves in achieving these targets. It would have been a bit more easier for us to set lower targets and achieve it, but I think that would paint an incorrect picture. What we did is we said this is what we want to see in terms of stretching ourselves to capacity. And if we do not achieve that, then we can adjust it in terms of the capacity that we have. But we shouldn't be targeting a lower lower requirement and then trying to move upwards thereafter. So I've also mentioned this to the minister during party session that we had, that we need ambitious targets, we have stretch targets, and I think this is in accordance with Jack Welch's philosophy of strategic management, that you fix up stretch targets, and then as you move towards it, you can then manage to bring it in what's realistic thereafter. We processed 3,581 LOA applications. Of these, 3,497 were processed within 120 days, which translates to a 90% achievement in the organization.
Yes.
Is working days or calendar days?
Okay. In 2015-16, it was working days.
Yeah.
In 2016-17, then we changed from working days to calendar days.
Yes.
You will recall that there was a lot of discussion last year, and then we moved from working days to calendar days.
Yeah.
In the chemicals, materials, and mechanical sector, a total of 4,866 inspections were conducted against 5,600. And there was variance of about 13% there. 1,993 of these were source inspections, and 2,873 were retail inspections. That's what market can see. 484 LOAs were processed during the year, which 158 were processed within 128 days, which reflects a 34% variance. However, I want to say that the 34% variance is because of the dormant disease on safety lasing and treated timber. During the course of the year, it was towards the latter part of the year we actually started activating those VCs. However, the applications for those LOAs in those VCs are coming some time ago. But we had to, it remained dormant because of capacity and training issues and so forth. So once we have got the capacity up and running to be able to do the surveillance work on the untreated, treat some similar and safety cases, then we start giving attention to the LOAs. And therefore, you find that there is a sort of a distorted performance in terms of the LOAs, but that is the explanation for it, and the information of course is available at the analysis to support that. In terms of the electrotechnical, a total of 4,890 inspections were conducted against a total of 4,400 variants, positive variance of 11%. 2,761 of these were sourced, consequently in manufacturing concerns, and 2,129 of these were retail inspections. We processed 5,592 LOA applications. Of these, 68% were processed within the 120 working days, and Madam Chair, I think we discussed this morning what we've done, the interventions, immediate interventions we've implemented to actually address the situation, and we are quite certain that by the end of October this would normalize itself, given the explanations as far as that's concerned this morning. In the legal methodology sector, a total of 6,440 inspections were conducted against 5,189. And this is simply because when we go to the source, we are able to do a lot more in terms of labeling weight measurements. But any product that comes in, whether it's an electrotechnical product or a cement product, all of them have labeling requirements. And these are all legal methodology requirements in terms of, if you say, for example, there are 10 plugs in a packet. That's a legal methodology. So legal methodology demands that the country must get 10 plugs and not 9 or not 8. So therefore we are able to do a little more in terms of legal methodology. We processed 1,135 gaming LA, and we processed all the type approval certificates in 120 days. In terms of the most foods and associated industries, you would recall, Madam Chair, that we deal with all the products that are declared to us. So all the locally produced canned fish and meat products, all 100% of them that were declared, we inspected them, and we did 3,190 inspections in canned fish environment and 4,019 in the canned meat environment. We conducted 1,016 frozen fish inspections against a target of 1,045. That's a variance of 3%, and we inspected 100% of all the imported canned fish. The first was locally produced, so this is imported. We had canned fish imported in the country as well, meat and frozen fish. 7,524 inspections were conducted in that respect. We inspected 100% of all the export fish. So we export to other countries in the world, and because the food is the competent authority for health certificates, 13,748 inspections were done in that area. We conducted 1,016 fishery and canned meat processing factory and vessel inspections. So these are where we process our meats and foods, fishery products locally, and those vessels that go out to catch these fishery products and process them as well. Against a target of 1,020, we conducted 1,069. in terms of our strategy goal 3, which is to inform and educate our stakeholders about the NRCS, we distribute 12 internal and 4 external electronic publications. 2 multimedia events campaigns were conducted during the year. 10 consumer education events and campaigns were conducted, and as I mentioned previously, these are conducted normally at taxi ranks, at malls, at bus ranks, and so forth. And I had discussed the last time I was here, and I got a poor performance, that the awareness survey was not conducted because I was complying with governance requirements. The supply chain management, we were out of the time for that, but we intend to finalize again this year. In terms of regional resources, our vacancy rate was 6.8%. We trained 158 employees during the year, and the ICT system was on average 98% available during the course of the financial year for our work. Madam Chair, I will hand over to the CEO now just to deal with the financial performance, and then I'll go to the first of the topic.
So initially a snapshot in terms of the financial information and financial performance for the year. If you look at levies, you will notice that there has been a decline in terms of the collection levies. The main contributor to that is the economic conditions we're currently facing. Our levies are based on volumes imported or manufactured. And further added to that is obviously the element of non-compliance within the industry, but it's mainly due to economic performance. Then we also have a 16% reduction in core funding. This is the government funding that's allocated from National Treasury. The drop is predominantly due to the fact that, once again, government as a whole is struggling in terms of funds due to the fact that NRCS has had a cash surplus. The amount was reduced from the prior year, and we could potentially see further reductions going on into RTOs as well. So in terms of income, your total income essentially declined by 6% from 330 million down to 309 million. On expenditure, you have a 10% increase in employee cost from the prior financial year and a 12% increase in operational expenditure. Total expenditure on average increased by 11%, moving from 278 million to 308 million. You'll notice in 2015, NRCS had a surplus of 52 million. Essentially, in the current financial year, due to reduction in core funding and obviously with expenditure increasing as per normal, you're sitting with a mere surplus of 1.6 million for the financial year. So in terms of the makeup of expenditure, you essentially have your 7-year trend, which we're demonstrating for you. The trend, as you can see, we're looking at expenditure increasing and revenue has declined. So the red bar you see there is our expenditure and the blue bar is our revenue. The green bar is surplus. And you can see in the 2016 year, 1.6 million. And in terms of revenue, the basic make of revenue in terms of our 7-year trend, I'll take it to the outer year, which is the 2016 financial year. So you're looking at 154 million on levy, moving from 166 million of the prior year. You can notice the decline there. You also notice the decline in terms of core funding. And then your other income is essentially your interest and you know the expenditure that we collect from staff in terms of parking and things like that. So you do see an overall decline in terms of revenue. For expenditure, you're essentially once again looking at a 7-year trend on expenditure. There is a fairly stable growth on overall expenditure, total expenditure, which is the green line. You also notice the employee cost expenditure that grows over a period of time, and then your goods and services, which does not increase by that much. And that's predominantly due to the fact that we've implemented a lot of the cost containment measures and some within the organization to try and not release cash from our services to fund operating expenditures. As I indicated earlier, cash really is for our capital projects, and essentially that's where we want to be utilized. Then, in terms of the Auditor General report, so as you all know, NRCS currently sits with the revenue qualification. Before I get into it, I think one thing worth mentioning is that the organization has made significant progress in terms of its audit report. The audit report for the prior year did have a number of issues on it. In the current year, essentially, this is the only issue we're sitting with. So it is a technical qualification. We are qualified based on GRAP. GRAP is generally recognized accounting practice. At this stage, our big issue is the point of collection of our revenue. GRAP requires us to collect our revenue on import or manufacture. Given our system constraints and the challenges that we have with regard to access to that information, it's evident why we have this issue. So essentially what NRCS has done is we've looked at GRAP non-exchange transactions, we've engaged with the AG, we've essentially agreed with the AG in terms of some of the high-level measures that we need to put in place. We're also looking at the NRCS Act to look at strengthening the Act to ensure better punitive measures for non-compliance and also clarifying the point of recognition of revenue. We're also looking at our systems and our controls internally, together with integration of information from a third party as well. SARS was mentioned. We are planning a meeting now with the SARS Commissioner as well to look how best we can gather this information from SARS. Integration with SARS will allow us a lot of comfort, especially due to the fact that the bulk of what we regulate is imported. So from a risk point of view, it will essentially assist NRCS. So as indicated previously, we have four big categories that we're focusing on. Our legislative aspects cover the opinion in terms of the Act, looking at where we need to strengthen our Act, specifically for punitive measures to compel payment of levies. The second thing that we need to look at is what the CEO alluded to have stronger measures in place to make sure that levies are paid, given the fact that we have industries that are just blatantly non-compliant. We will be looking at re-looking at the LOA conditionality wherein there are validity periods where you need to reapply once the period has lapsed, or you need to commit to us the units that you will be importing. That would allow us to recognize revenue based on an estimate, because right now we can't do that. This volume theory based on seasonality, based on economic performance. The other aspect that we've talked about a lot now as well are the internal control improvements. We want to look at an integrated system that allows us access to information right from the start of the NRCS value chain all the way to payment. And then finally our SARS collaboration, which I've alluded to. So where we are with regard to the legal opinion, we have finalized that process. We are now looking at engaging with DCI to see how best we can go ahead on this. We also have a meeting with DCI with regard to seeing how best we can look at our internal control environment and our Act as well. The LOA conditionality, that's still in the investigation stage. Obviously, we're aware that there might be some implications associated with that, so we just want to make sure we've covered all our bases. The modernization, I think we've talked about extensively. I'm not going to go into that. And with the SARS collaboration, as indicated, we are going to be engaging with SARS on various different platforms, but they're a key player in this.
Okay, I'll go to the first part of the report now.
You had an audit, you know, qualification which you've referred to, and there were recommendations noted. And I think it is to be welcomed that you've dealt with all of these recommendations. Just you to put such measures in to perform an analysis on the adequacy of the systems and processes that have been put in place to reliably measure, etc., and get the estimate of the fee revenue. They have also asked you to look into whether the processes support the current levy model, and again to improve internal controls around the performance information systems and so on. The point being that there were recommendations made, and quite clearly
from your presentation here, you've been able to address that. You are putting in, or you have already put in, these measures. I think that is commendable. Thank you. Honourable Mkongi, just on that point, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Eerste Hazen, Honourable Albert, is that yourself, Honourable Colonel? Honourable Colonel, Honourable Williams.
Thank you very much, Professor. I think perhaps this question is supposed to be asked by Honourable Williams. Maybe just forget about it. Now, there's something that I want to gather in terms of your plans, because in your annual report, you are not telling us what is your plan. There's a few things that you are talking about, the IoT systems, optimization, and so on. And nothing that you're telling us, that what are you going to do with the workers? I see that there is training that's taking place. Are all these workers going to be integrated into the new system? All of them, or there will be consequences for some of the workers? And I don't see that plan coming up, because this is going to impact on the workers. Thank you.
Just indicate the annual report will refer to previous period, and I think that question may well apply to the first quarter, which we're still getting. So, all right, carry on. Thank you. Honourable Eerste Hazen. MacPherson, sorry.
Thank you very much. I think over the long term, coming up to the present, I think that the expenditure has been growing for a number of reasons, also out of your control when it comes to salaries, etc., far quicker than your income has been growing. In fact, your income has been depleted because of budget cuts. And I think that this speaks to a concern that I have for the long-term sustainability, financial sustainability of the NRCS. And it brings into question the ability then to fund capital projects such as the new automated system. So, CEO, to you and your team, what are the discussions with the DTI to try and, I mean, obviously you need to expand, you know, the infrastructure of the entity that requires, you know, financial assistance from the DTI, and truly not just from your own cash reserves, because I think you and I both know that's not going to happen. It can't happen. You don't have enough reserves to fund an IT system such as this and your other commitments. So if you can just walk us through that, I'd be grateful.
Thank you, Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. The Illumination Engineering Society of South Africa has actually asked for a memorandum of understanding between the NRCS and SABS. They've actually also asked for Regulation R999 to be reinstated. Because the industry just can't afford, I'm looking at page 9 and all the components mentioned here as affected are, they, you know, the letter of understanding and the levy paid, so the industry just can't afford both. And how far do they get with that? Sure.
Thank you,
Honourable Eerste
Hazen,
and
Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think a lot of your financials show that your lack of income has to do with the fact that there's a lot of non-compliance, and I think the non-compliance also has to do with the fact that your regulations of compulsory specifications are product-specific, and you haven't quite answered my previous question with regard to creating generic compulsory specification. Electronic products have basically the same component, just in different configurations. So why can't that be done so that you can actually go to any store or go to any supplier and just inspect in general? So you wouldn't have to have the specifications for a television set and one for a Wi-Fi system. You have one that would cover all of those types of products, including cell phones. which will make it easier for you just to basically inspect things, as opposed to coming to a place where you find, oh, there's no certification, I can't do anything against these people. That will broaden your scope and your mandate, and implement, or give you more powers to implement your mandate to ensure that companies and business comply with the specifications and can be forced to make them close to these payments. And that should have an effect on your bottom line as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Honourable Kuhn.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. One on your negative achievement for chemicals, materials and mechanicals is about 34, just over 34%. And then when you go to electrotechnical, it's about 32%. I think those are the two higher ones. Is there a specific reason for that? And then on the finances, I just want to know the first quarter of 2016, in terms of the revenue collection, would it be low budget or over budget?
Thank you. William?
Thank you, Chairperson. This SG was, when we discussed the Auditors General, it came out that this entity was the second worst performing entity in the DDI stable. And I just want to know, with regard to the Auditor General's the report that we received, the following items were matters of concern. Under leadership, it's oversight responsibility, effective HR management, policy and procedures, audit action plans, and ICT governance. And also, the Auditor General highlighted a red block, which is intervention required under financial and performance management, the regular, accurate, and complete, I'm assuming that means records or reports. And I'd like to know that this is going to be much improved this time next year, and I'd like to know what measures you're putting in place so that next year you can just have one big green block covering your entity. Thank you.
Honourable William. Chief Financial Officer, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Yes, sorry, Chair, perhaps you can see my hand. Okay. I would just speak about the performance contract. Is that right?
Yes, we're on the end.
Great, thank you. I think many of these questions might be directed to the Director General of the DTI. The first thing that struck me from the contract we received this morning is that it was signed yesterday. So, you know, I just want to say I take a dim view of the department telling us a few weeks ago that the contract was confidential, when in fact there was no contract in place. Why wasn't the department just upfront and frank about the fact that no contract had yet been signed? Instead, it suggested that the contract was confidential, which infers that there is a contract, but that you don't want to release it, when in fact, today we see that it was signed on the 13th of September, yesterday. I don't think that that is playing open cards with the committee. And can you confirm that prior to yesterday, I mean, has there been a contract in place with the CEO, a performance contract in place prior to this one that was signed yesterday? And why was that one not given to the committee, if indeed such a contract was in place? And if it wasn't in place, how does the DTI explain the reason for it being in contravention of the Act? Because the Act requires a performance contract between the Minister and this Chief Executive Officer.
Honourable Fernandez, allow me to just address that point from a letter contained in the letter notice written to me by the Minister. Particularly in that regard, I'll read the letter out. Just switch your mic off. It says, expect to me, the date of yesterday, the letter. Attached, please find a performance agreement with the financial officer, Mr. Essinger Moodley, of the NRCF. Please note that it was initially sent to my office on the 10th of June 2016, and it was reviewed. Several areas of misalignment were noted with the current annual performance plan, APP. And in my letter dated the 10th of August, I indicated to the CEO that he needed to revise both the APP of the NRDS and the subsequently his revised performance agreement. The DTI also met with the CEO and the NRCS management on the 22nd of August 2016 to discuss areas to improve in the APP. The revised APP was received on 8 September 2016. Hence, the performance agreement was resubmitted on the 12th of September 2016 and is attached.
Thank you very much.
As a sign that you don't have a copy of this.
Thank you very much. I accept that explanation. So the only question that still stands then is, prior to June 2016, what contract was in place between Mr. Moody, the Chief Executive Officer, and the Minister? Then, if I can just go to the detail of the performance indicators themselves, many of the deadlines that have been set in the presentation given to us by the NRCS today are not reflected in the performance agreements. And I want to make sure that the NRCS leadership is held accountable to the commitments that are made today in terms of the timelines for the implementation for the risk-based system. And so I want to ensure that those timelines are reflected in this document. Now, this document says that it's only valid until March 2017, so it might be the case that as of the 1st of April 2017, the new contract contains the timelines that the NRCS is now committed to. But at the moment, these performance indicators are very generic and don't hold the NRCS to specific performance achievement targets. And what I would like to see is what we've discussed today, all of the timelines on the RBA, the RBS, all of the timelines on the IT system, all of the timelines on this, the specific timelines on turnarounds, on LOAs, those reflected in the performance agreement so that we can hold the Chief Executive Officer accountable for performance against him. Thank you.
We're addressing that to some extent to the DG. Right. I was just going to raise one or two points myself before you came in. And I think I did raise it was with respect to the recommendations in this regard. Thank you. Right, over to yourself. Perhaps, DD, would you like to come in first?
I'd like the opportunity for our group CEO to either in writing or at another occasion to give a very, very detailed response on this matter. But let me assure Andrew Lewis there's no intention to mislead or to give any. As you know, we do have a very, very rigorous and transparent system in place. And I think one of the best in government where the minister himself, as the executive authority, sits with all the accounting officers twice a year. And as I indicated, we set up an agency management unit over the past 5-6 years, where we in detail integrate all our agencies, so there's active oversight and management. I do assume also that because of our performance agreement runs from April to March every year, I would assume that everybody has to have a performance agreement. So if we gave any indication, it was my understanding that everybody. Of course, as you will know, especially with this entity, which as we know is one of our entities, which is one of the worst performing within the DTI stable. And we have been fixing up the management problem. As you know, even the current CEO was brought in from Delco to turn this organization around, because there was major problems about 4 or 5 years ago, where almost the entire senior management team has left. So in this particular performance agreement, there has been a vigorous interaction with our team, who refused to accept the targets that was put forward by the CEO. So there was an active engagement to try to revise those targets and to make them more consistent with our objectives and so on. But as I said, our GCOO and the unit can give a detailed indication. And what we do with each of our 16 entities, there is a lot of toing and throwing on those targets before it gets to the minister's desk. Because, and then the minister himself sits with the CEO, because as you know, he must regularly then mock the person on the performance agreement. And so we are part of that. But all I can assure you is that we do have a very rigorous system in place, and we all
also try to set targets which is in line with our performance plans. So, but what we will do is on a specific performance contract, we can give you more blow-by-blow accounts of how we have tried to interact to get a very, very robust performance agreement in place.
Right. I'm just addressing that area for the moment. I think that that is a reasonable request. Do we agree? Yes. I don't see any objections, DG. Right. Now we're back on track with as for your responses to the others, Mr. Midley.
Thank you very much, Alison. With regard to the IT system, the impact on the employees, Honourable Nkongi, I think we have seen by now that the wealth realisation is quite huge. I don't think we will ever have full capacity to do the amount of work there in the economy, considering the fiber for economy, the amount of surveillance work and so forth that we require to do. So the IT system will assist us, but it will not take away any staff. The staff members are continuing doing, in fact, we'll be able to do a lot more, we'll be able to focus a lot more on the risk, on the areas of high risk, and we will be able to be a lot more effective in, and efficient in the processes. I think this was communicated to the staff members as well. And this IT system was just simply supported to support the organization going forward. So we do training as we presented in the annual report. We've exceeded our targets for training because we also subscribe to the learning organization. So as we progress, our employees must grow with the learning as well. In terms of the expenditure growing for a number of reasons, I agree, one of my questions that come up, a lot of these was out of control. We had to deal with lots and lots of issues that we had inherited. And yes, indeed, we've been forced to use some of our tax surpluses to fund some of our operations. Our tax surpluses would fund our operations in 3 years from now or 2 years from now, this year, next year. The third year, we will not be in a position to do that. Therefore, we've engaged with the DTI and so forth to actually keep our budget figures. You see, all our projections and plans were based on budget figures. Then we are forced to use our cash surplus, but our budget figures from the outer year onwards must remain for us to be able to continue our work. Secondly, we heard earlier today that we really are going to put in the measures to collect the amount of money that are due to us. In fact, when we collect all the levies that are due to us, then we will have quite a bit of money that we'll be able to. But to just give you a bit of comfort, the ICT system would be funded, we provided for that in our cash surpluses. We wrote to Treasury 2 years ago to keep some of the money to buy a building in Cape Town and to buy another building in Bloemfontein. We may have to relook at our priorities. The ICT system may be a higher priority than a building in Cape Town or a building in Bloemfontein, and therefore we will redirect the cash surplus to the ICT system. But just to give you that comfort, that I agree with you, finance is always a very difficult, very sensitive discussion topic, but we engage with the DTI. There's engagements all the time between our CFO and the DTI CFO, and it becomes, to such an extent, that it becomes unbearable when I also bring it up to the DD and the group CEO and we take it further from there. But I don't envisage that if the projected figures from the upper year onwards, well, we don't have any reasons not to achieve it. When we achieve these, then our sustainability won't be a problem. What will be a problem is if we have to grow at a very large rate in a very short period, then we would require seed funding until those things keep into place. In terms of the Illumination of Illumination Society of South Africa, you see, it's very difficult for us to have a MOU with SAS to not pay monies or pay monies, because SAS is a private entity, it's one of our service providers, and Treasury was clear with us. Although it forms within the DTI's family of entities, they rent services to us and we have to pay them for the services. And that's what you find in the performance contract for this year, is an amount of money that has been budgeted for testing services and so forth, which we will pay to testing houses that will do the work for us. Article 9 has been repealed, and of course we will communicate to the details through the channels for them to look at that. There's a voluntary part in terms of SAPS, and there's a compulsory part in terms of the specifications. What we're talking about is compulsory safety specifications. For us to do our work, we need to collect the money to do that. To have a MOU with SAPS that impacts on the third party's payment would be very, very difficult, considering that SAPS is a service provider to us. In terms of the generic and specific products, I think Mohani is better placed to answer that.
I do believe that we have the system in place, but I will go many months ago. Mr. Khalil to answer the question. In terms of the negative achievement in CLM and Eritrea, the Honorable Freedom of Identity mentioned earlier that Eritrea, it was in terms of the rigor and the volume of application, but now we've given the capacity to deal with that in September, October. In terms of CLM, the reason for the non-achievement is simply the inactive, the dormant VCs on Treats Timber and safety. Now that is active, that would be, there would be, wouldn't be sort of a, after the first quarter of 2016 and the second quarter onwards from 2016, there won't be a lag in that area. We'd be able to deal with that. If there is a lag, then of course we go in and we'll determine what the issues are and we'll attend to it urgently. Also now it was simply the common VCs that was in the area. I think in terms of second worst performing NCP, the DTI, yes indeed, and then without saying, I mean, we've made a huge turnaround since 2008. The only reason that we are the second worst performing entity is because of the revenue qualification. But if you look at our compliance with the governance process and so forth, we basically met all the requirements and we exceeded some of the requirements. Honorable Williams, the leadership, oversight and so forth is to deal specifically related to the revenue qualification. But we've got measures in place for all of that. The plans that the CFO has put into place, we will send it to Parliament as well, so that you have the same rising interest of what we've done to improve the finance, to improve the performance of the organization. And, Chairperson, yes, the recommendations in the AG report, you've heard the CFO. What we will do is we will give all this to Parliament so that you have it in the report as well. So, just the last one, I'll ask Brian just to speak about the product approach and the product approach and the general approach to VCs.
Thank you, CEO. Thank you, Chair. Actually, I think the issue here is about the model that South Africa has developed. And it's a model that uses specific products regulated and also specific parts of the product that is being regulated. And then the VC is developed based on that. Now, a generic regulation, it will also include things that are not of safety critical, which would be maybe things that deals with performance and which we are not regulating. So South Africa has decided to specifically regulate issues that impact on the environment as well as the health, safety and health of consumers. I think that's my response.
Thanks, Jefferson. Okay, then we'll go to the first quarter of 2016-17.
Do you want to comment on something, Honourable Williams? I think just one moment, Mr. Maybe. Yes, Honourable Williams, just sorry, followed briefly by Honourable Maxwell.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, this is not, it's just about the performance agreement. What I was wondering is whether we could have performance agreements from all the entities, from, you know, from all of the, across the board. Why should we pick on one entity? I think we should go pick on all entities here.
Talking about future practices, etc. Yeah. So we are simply rationalising our request here. Thank you. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. CEO, do you have a cost estimate for the full implementation of the system? And can you provide that to us? And then does your cash reserves cover that?
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. We do indeed have a cost estimate. We had a reputable company bring a presentation to us. Now, of course, you know that I can't disclose it because we have to go through the supply chain management processes, requests for inserts, requests for tenders and so forth. Governance has to be complied with. The cost estimate for the entire ICT system, right, cost of modernization of the entire system, approximately the initial estimate came out at about 50 million rands. So we've asked for a request, I mean, we went through the request for interest process and so forth, so that we open this out to a competitive process, and we are very certain that that amount of money would reduce because we went through the competitive process. But the benchmark figure was for the, let's say the Rolls-Royce system, is of approximately 50 million.
That's the Rolls-Royce, and you are giving Toyota.
I'm just trying to work out what you think. Honourable MacBook.
CEO, you know in China we prefer Hyundai's. So, if we're looking at an estimation of 50 million, then does your cash reserves cover that? Does it? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do want to close off here, but Honourable Hill Lewis.
I just wanted to say I support the call by Honourable Williams for all similar performance contracts. The only reason I originally requested this one and not others is because, to my knowledge, the NRCS Act is unique in that it stipulates in the actual act that there must be a performance contract, whereas I'm not sure that that's the case in some of the other acts that we deal with. So that's why there was the original request.
No, thank you very much, but I think there's no harm, and in fact there's every sense of treating them all the same. It's for question all of them. They must have performance contracts, even those who say it's not specific to sanctions. On that particular note, can we move now to the first quarterly report? It was a question you raised, Honourable Mpongi, which we can then apply here. All right, so I think you know the question. All right. It's just immediately respond to that.
Thank you. I think Madam Chair did respond to that question in terms of the impact of the observation of the staff members.
Now, will you give us the presentation, please?
Thank you very much. So, first quarter report, I'm going to go straight to the performance information. So, for the first quarter, two compulsory certifications annual. We supposed to do zero in quarter one, which is three compulsory specifications review events, new technical, so there was a bit of positive achievement there. In terms of number of technicals, BCs of technical regulations reviewed and reports produced, the target was one and one was done. In terms of feasibility studies, there was no target for the first quarter, but we managed to get two done on smoke issues and as a result of certain very urgent requests that were made to us. And in terms of the review board cases, all of them were done within the targets of clear aesthetics. Then in terms of inspections in the automotive units, we had planned 160 for the first quarter. We did 771 in the source inspections. Retail inspections, we planned 240 with 291. Total, we planned 1,262. There was a deficit because study needs and so forth. However, we are quite confident that we will, in fact, achieve these targets in terms of the second, third, and fourth quarters. In the first quarter, it's always a matter of setting them, and then in the second, third, and fourth quarter, in terms of the targets themselves, we will be able to achieve them. In terms of the automotive approvals, the target is 100% within 120 days, 98.54%. 2013 were done, and it's a negative variance of 1.46% under. In terms of the CMM units, 800 were cross inspection the target, which is 566. 900 retail was targeted, which is 746. 1,700 in total, we did 1,312, that's 23% under. Again, it's annual leave, and then here we had redirected some of the surveillance inspectors to deal with the alloys as well. So that had an impact on our
Mr. Wrigley, remember we've just raised this clarification on calendar and working.
Yes.
Exactly. No, without page number, but you know, two, what was it on automotive? Bottom there, you've got calendar days and working days. This is 2016-2017. Just clarification there.
It's working days. It's working days. I think this quarter one target of calendar days is wrong. If you look at actual performance, we've moved to working days. Yeah. In 2016-2017, the target is working days. And in terms of...
Is that calendar days?
Sorry, my apologies. Calendar days.
Don't worry,
the class will work. Yeah, no, it's calendar days, not working days. So I think that's the typo there. You can see that the target and the quarter one target is calendar days. I think that's just about the typo there. It's supposed to be calendar days.
Right.
that as in CMM, there was the variance there is basically because we've now allocated some of the inspectors to deal with the LOA. As I said, in the first quarter, we still find a variance in the LOAs, but certainly second, third, and fourth quarters, we'll catch them up. But we also have to do a review of our performance in terms of market surveillance, because as you will recall from this morning's discussion, even in the electrotechnical environment, we've asked surveillance inspectors to start assisting in the LOA area, and during the month of September and October, we've taken surveillance officials from other units to assist in the LOA sector. So it would mean that those targets that we're supposed to keep in the surveillance area will have to be reduced in order to accommodate the assistance that we have in the LOA area. Because the capacity is standard, but we need to adjust the capacity to deal with the areas of pressure that we have. Then in the electrotechnical unit, we've been discussing this morning, we've targeted 528 source inspectors, 836 was done, 352 retail inspections, and 461 was achieved, 880 was targeted for quarter one, and 1,297 was achieved. And this is because of the influx of identified non-compliant products. Remember, Madam Chair, we did indicate that we had a targeted risk-based approach. And as the more of the regulated products come in, it requires that we must give a bit more attention to those areas to ensure that only compliant products come into the marketplace. Sometimes our targets will have to be adjusted according to seasonality as well. Then in terms of the LOAs, we discussed this. We had a minus 30% underachievement, but as I said, in quarter two and quarter three, we will claw back with the additional capacity that we've allocated to the LOAs, as well as the assistance that we've now directed from the other units. In terms of legal methodology, 1,045 source inspections were planned, 1,438 was achieved. 300 retail inspections were planned, but only 236 achieved. 1,345 were planned in total, 1,600 was achieved. And here again, we've dedicated resources to source, and we've reduced a little bit in the retail because we found that there was a lot more products coming in through that required, in terms of our risk-based target approach, that required more attention. In terms of the LOAs, in both cases, the targets were achieved. In the foods and associated industries, in terms of inspections conducted on all locally produced canned fish and meat products, all of them that declared were inspected. In terms of frozen products, we targeted 271 inspections, but we did 272. In terms of the imported canned fish and meat and frozen fishery products, all of that was declared that was we were done there, 100% of them, and that comes to 2053. In terms of the request for canned meat and fish in terms of exporting these products, all of them that were declared, 3,655 in the first quarter were done. Inspections on the canned meat processing plants and the vessels themselves, 270 was planned, but we did 229 because we do this as scheduled and in terms of the number of requests that we receive from industry. And we found that in the first quarter, the number of requests from industry was a little lower than normal. And these are also very seasonal in nature, depending on how many boats are to sea and what catches and things like that. Then in terms of multimedia, in terms of strategic goal three, that is our marketing communications environment, multimedia, we planned 3 for quarter one, 3 internal and 1 external publication, we have achieved that. Multimedia awareness, these are quarter two targets, so we haven't, we'll do that in quarter two. In terms of stakeholder consumer education, 3 was planned, but we achieved 5 because we participated in some of the initiatives arranged by the DTI as well, consumer campaign, so we were able to achieve a little more than all. And in terms of capacity, we still at 6.8%, our target is 6%, we are putting in place measures to achieve that target. And then in terms of delivering, approving, and implementing an ICT master system plan, quarter one, the target was to develop to conduct needs analysis on the master system plan. This was conducted, and an MRCS is in the process of finalizing the normalization project. And I think, Madam Chair, this morning we had a considerable discussion, lengthy discussion on the modernization project, and this is essentially what we are talking about in this ICT area.
So with regards
the financial performance, just a brief overview. I want to start off at the bottom line, which is the surplus deficit. So as you'll notice, for the year, for the full year, we're looking at a potential surplus of 125,000. So we've cut it very fine. The first quarter performance reflects an actual deficit of 22 million. Just to put it in context, our revenue is cyclical. So you will find in the first quarter and the third quarter very little levy revenue coming in. We usually request our core funding in the first part of the year to basically supplement our expenditure. So you do find the strength, it's absolutely normal. In the second quarter report, you will, however, notice the difference when the levies do come in. So I think that's to answer the question that was asked earlier. So in terms of our budget, we had originally planned or anticipated a deficit of 19 million. So you can see there's about a 3 million difference there. And on expenditure, we're looking at an expenditure of 21 million versus a planned expenditure of 72 million. So there was some savings there. And then if I take you to the revenue amount, so this is really the makeup of the revenue that we have. You will notice that the government funding for quarter one basically supplements us. So we're looking at 53% what's coming in quarter one, coming in from government, 14% coming in from levies, and 28% from services. This dynamic obviously changes as the year proceeds. Then in respect of our revenue, this is really just a graphic in terms of where we were from the audited figures versus the budget that we have. You notice that the budgeted figures are slightly higher than the audited figures, but one that is lower is the first bar, the red and the blue bars, and the red slightly lower, and that is because of the reduction in government funding. Then in terms of expenditure, once again on a high level, for the first quarter, you're looking at employee costs sitting at 18% of total expenditure. And once again, the reason for this is really expenditure build up as the year proceeds. So you'll find a lot of the procurement in terms of testing, traveling, etc. will be incurred in the second and third quarter as well. A lot of our additional costs in terms of some of the providers we've appointed, specifically on the levy audit side, which is one of the mechanisms we're now putting in place to compel some clients, you will see the goods and figure services jumping up as well. So basically, in terms of expenditure, once again, I draw your attention to the red and the blue bars again. So you look at employees' costs, but our budget is higher than last year's actual, and exactly the same for goods and services. So we do expect to spend a little bit more on goods and services. And essentially, the quarter performance, as indicated already, our budget was slightly underspent for goods and services in the prior quarter, and the same with employee costs. And then for the purposes of our quarterly report, we give you an indication of where we spent the bulk of our money in terms of the goals that we have on our strategic plan. The goal that attracts the most spending is goal 2, which is really our surveillance activities that currently is sitting within actual 46 million. Goal 4 is the second highest, and goal 4 really is the support element, which is HR, IT, finance. We're sitting with around 12 million expenditure there. The third goal is our administrative, the third one that attracts the most spending is admin costs, which is all of the business units that don't fall into a particular goal, which is around 9 million. But one is compulsory specification development, and goal 3 is marketing. So just so that you get a feel for where the spread of the expenditure is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if you want me to go to challenge analysis. We've dealt with it in biggest, so I think we can skip that for now, with your permission. And then, well, that would be the... Thank you.
Right. Just take us forward a wee bit, and the way we want to look at it for the beat for our purpose, we've had the annual report, all right? Now, we haven't looked at the annual report, and identifying these were the challenges there. As we move into the first quarter, which we know is slower than most, except perhaps in a basic education where the expenditure is extremely high in the first, rather occurred the last calendar quarter. But you do have a trend emerging, and you should theoretically be able to see that trend by fixing that is the first quarter will be slower in uptake. Alright? Now, do we think we are where we want to be with this entity? I think that's really a question. Are we on track? Or are there some alerts you want to take up? If you fall asleep, let me, Honourable and Congi.
But I had a question of the, for TG. Maybe if it's going to summarize all the entities, it might be my last time I see you again. Can I ask that question? No, no, until you come there. No, TG was concerned, and then I wanted just maybe because I was not around yesterday. I'm just interested for you to explain to me. The thing, when I got your report, it spoke about high impact naturalization. No, not this one. You spoke about high impact naturalization in most of your arguments. But yesterday, you spoke about full-scale naturalization and inclusive growth. I wanted to understand what the relationship between the two, because these concepts are many. And we don't know whether we mean the very same thing. But it goes also into blaming of entities and how they account in both these terminologies, high impact, or we have moved from there into the full scale.
Thank you, DJ.
I think the, as I said, we obviously the DTI, especially since the minister came into office in 2009, we have been able to develop what we call the project of industrialization. That we know that the reason South Africa and Africa is poor is because it is not industrialized. It's a simple issue. The rest of the world has overtaken us. Asia is industrialized, South America is industrialized, so we remain the only continent that is unindustrialized, and therefore we are poor, therefore we have wars, we have instability, which are all the symptoms of underdevelopment, and therefore under-industrialization. So now that we've succeeded in getting all of society behind us on this project, we want to now, as I said, that's why we're saying we must now complete the journey. Now, South Africa is one of the world's first industrialized countries. From the 1880s and the discovery of mines, we deindustrialized. We were one of the first. But it was a very funny kind of industrialization. It was incomplete because it excluded people from that industrialization. Secondly, it was autarkic. It was basically based on the inward. We were cut off from the rest of the world. So it was, for example, our auto industry only maybe supplied 100 million cars, because the only people they supplied was white middle class. So our industry was small because the demand side was small. So that's why we want to have this term. We don't want to have the same kind of industrialization as previously we want to. That's why we add the word inclusive. So it's a full-scale inclusive. So we distinguish it from the past, but we also say we must go the complete route now. And then the final thing I mentioned was, we are finally getting to the question of the continent now. Recently, the minister was in a meeting, and there's a new group called KENSA, which is like a G4 for Africa. South Africa, Egypt, Kenya, and Nigeria. We are going to use these four countries to, just like in Europe, the French-German axis drove European industrialization. They even today in the EU, there's joint cabinet meetings between France and Germany to drive the European project. So that is why we now have the term of full scale and then inclusive. The high impact is, as you know, in the 9-point plan, which so we are the authors of the 9-point plan, yeah, so you can ask us any questions, yeah. As the authors of the 9-point plan, as you know, the purpose of the 9-point plan was to introduce big thing on agriculture. So we say the reason South Africa has a high unemployment rate is because we have an undeveloped agriculture sector. So we have to bring agriculture back and it was. That was one of the big ones. But we had to introduce the iPad. We had to still keep industry in the 9-point plan. So what we said was we will try to have a higher impact iPad, meaning higher impact on jobs. And therefore the bigger in the 9-point plan, we talk about higher impact iPad, meaning higher impact on employment. So that is where the higher impact comes from.
Right. Members, I think we have come to the end of this particular engagement with the NRCS. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We will be getting the transcript back next week, Mr. Herman. Right. So I really would like to thank all of those who came here this morning from the NRCS. Thank you very, very much. I'd like to thank the DTI, the DG that is, and also our senior person from the IDD, Chief Director Dr. Lane, and political advisors here are also here today. So we want to simply thank you. I'm adjourned in just a minute. I hold your horses, members. The just a reminder that we are meeting, as I explained yesterday. SARS could not make Friday or Thursday, neither could they make, neither could succeed in the end. So they are coming on Tuesday, and we'll do that with the BRRR. But we will have to finish the colloquium this week, the second draft. That will be issued to you in the morning, tomorrow morning sometime, the second draft, as members of this committee. You are required to read it, try your minds, and if you have a recommendation, the different parties, that is, if you would see them through the IFP, the Freedom Front, the VA, the ANC, directly to Mr. Hermans, you will be dealing with it, or Mr. Medina. Mr. Medina, but it can go to Mr. Hermans as well, we'll pass them over. Now, we would like to have that with us. At the same time, we would like to have the system going, Mr. Hermans, with it overhead, so that we can immediately make changes to some of the recommendations. Are we all on track there? So that is sometime tomorrow. Now, we're not adopting it. I hope that's clear. It is still draft. And then you can study that over weekend, and when we get back on Tuesday, I don't think we're looking at it again. When will we be looking at it again? It'll be Wednesday, is it? No, it is Tuesday.
Then we can...
Yes, we will be looking at it again on the 18th. Consideration of the first, it's got the first draft. 16th, rather. That's Friday, and on the 20th, we'll be doing that. Well, I think it is for consideration and probably the adoption then on Wednesday. All right. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, sorry, I just want some clarity. Are we meeting on Friday?
This Friday, the office. It was scheduled some time ago.
And I see Honourable MacPherson looking at me with consternation. In future, and this must be noted, Mr. Hermans, I did point this out to Mr. Medina. In future, we will meet at 9:30 on Tuesday morning. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
I place on record my sincere appreciation. I will be there around 10 o'clock on a Tuesday.